Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on October 28th, 2015. My ruler of time, here alongside Rolo T. What's going on, man?
It's Halloween, Nick. Are you excited?
Particularly.
That sounded rather like not in the spirit.
It is not in the spirit, but I have not been in. I'm not a really big Halloween guy.
It is really weird to me that like the only theme month we do is for the holiday. Both of us have like unanimously been like, eh.
I mean,
to promote a genre, we're both like, meh.
Why do we do this again?
It fits so perfectly once.
Next year, we're gonna end up doing like fucking romantic comedy month.
Yeah, it's just like it's love month, and I'm like, Nick, we're in a little romance series, and I'm like, all right, I hate all shoujo. I've like two of them thus far.
What's the difference, though? Ain't them both anyway.
I feel like we need to find a way to make, like, a battle shounen month out of, like, I don't know, 4th of July.
We
like,
do that anyway, though.
We need a theme month for it. No, I'm good, Nick. I had a rough start to my day.
Oh?
It was a bit bad. Woke up kind of late. Stuff happened. Missed the first bus. Kind of waiting outside. It's raining. Crazy heavy here. Like, the pant legs were just soaked, and I'm getting into work. I'm on my way to the doors, and a car zooms by me and just hits a puddle going at that speed that like creates like a tidal wave. It was like something out of a bad day montage. Like
had a bad day.
Yeah, and I just look up. Oh no,
Rolo T and the no good, horrible, awful, very bad day.
Yeah, like Steve Carell runs by in a pirate costume with his arms on fire. Oh no, this is wacky. And I turn around, there's a big fat guy in a giant suit who's like falling off the treadmill because his fantasy team has no wins. I'm like, oh, all the things about bad days I don't like.
That is a great commercial.
And it's always annoyed me that the fat Giants guy is the guy with no wins.
Yeah.
Like, this one chick's crying. She's like, I'm 4-12. I'm like, that fat guy's 0-16!
Yeah, the really weird part about it is the most miserable person is the one that does okay.
Yeah. I'm like, if I was that fat dude, I would be like, can I even hang from the rafters, or am I just gonna break them? Like, my fantasy team. It's pretty sad. But I guess that's in its own way, also kind of like the spirit of Halloween.
Yeah, bad shit happening to you for no discernible reason. Just having black cats cross your path or some stuff like that.
Yeah, or like maybe I pissed off a ghost or something. Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
No? Okay.
I believe in an existence after death that science cannot explain. And I also believe that attempts to scientifically explain said phenomenon are bullshit. And are an excuse for the Discovery Channel to fill out time.
Hmm. Okay.
A little bit of an insight into Nick's spiritual beliefs.
I feel like that's gonna anger the ghosts, the podcast ghosts, the ghosts of podcast cast.
Ghosts of
the ghosts of podcast past. They have a joke at first. They're like, they're the ghosts of podcast cast. That's just our gag. No, we do the boast. We're the ghosts of podcast.
No, but seriously,
cast.
You're dead.
No, seriously, we are going to shove this chainsaw up your rectum. Like, oh no! But why? Because I said I don't believe in ghosts? They're like, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Ghosts aren't fair. I don't know where you got that impression.
It's okay, though. This is basically your punishment. It's not like an eternity where you get, you know, tortured by the devil or anything like that. Just, you know, One instant of chainsaw, and then, you know, we hang out and we record podcasts that no one will ever listen to.
I'm like, oh, so it's just like my regular life then, except with the chainsaw.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, it is Halloween month. We should be excited. We are talking about a series that at least has more direct horror elements than Monster, even though I guess both of these series can be rather heavily debated on whether or not they're horror in any way, shape, or form.
I would call this more actually of a sci-fi series than a horror series. Mm-hmm. Kind of a sci-fi action series, I think. I think it's bad sci-fi, but basically, yeah, it's a lot of sci-fi, but a bit of horror. I briefly talked about it years ago when one of the first videos I ever did, which was a video discussing manga that I would not do individual in-depth reviews on. So this was one among them. It's called Parasite, and in that video I compared it to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Now that you've read it, do you think that that is an apt description?
I've not seen Invasion of the Body Snatchers, though I'm vaguely aware of the premise of it. Mm-hmm. So from what I know of Invasion, they're very similar.
These, I believe they're described as being like tennis ball sized, but they're like spores that fall to Earth from space. The origin is never explained. There are a lot of things in this manga that are never explained. It is more set up to have occasional discussions of, you know, humanity's role and their relation to the world and so on and so forth. What it means to be human, what it means to be an animal other than a human, and so on. Stuff like that. So it doesn't really matter where the stuff came from. But basically, these spores fall to Earth, and they seek out human brains. They kind of turn into these worm-like creatures, maybe kind of like Yerks from Animorphs, or Facehuggers, if you were.
I love the sweet fucking Animorphs reference, by the way.
Oh, and Animorphs was my jam for like 8 years, so...
Who are you, a Casey guy or a Rachel guy, Nick?
Cassie, by the way.
Whatever. That's not Casey.
I think
it's a children's book, Nick.
It was a young adult book.
That is true.
I liked Rachel more than Cassie, but I liked all of them, honestly. They were all really good characters, I think. We should do an Animorphs podcast sometime. I've got most of the books still. The only books I don't have are just the ones that I never picked up because I stopped. I finally got tired of them after about book 42 or some shit like that. And then it was like, oh shit, the series finished, and I got the last one. So I missed about a year's worth of books in between. But anyway, they're all ghostwritten anyhow by that point.
I was about to say, like, how does someone write a book series for 42 books? And I was like, I guess most of them probably... I'm sure what's her name, something Applegate.
K.A. Applegate. And in her defense, she did actually, like, tell her ghostwriters, you know, she wrote, like, in-depth summaries that they were to follow. And they did write based on her style, because they were, like, pupils of hers or something. Anyway, also she was working on a different series at the time, too. So she had a good excuse.
You say pupils, and I can't help but think of, like, an entire Sith Empire where she's the leader, and everyone, she has, like, her fucking apprentices, and she's they're just fine, forcing them to kill each other fine, out.
They're fighting to be the Darth Applegate.
Yeah. Good, good. More sadness. Angst, angst! Tobias's life hasn't been hard enough yet.
Oh, God.
Perhaps his bird should get cancer. I'm like, oh, no. Aww.
It's okay, he just morphs out of it and then comes back and he's fine.
And they get stuck in a bird form again. Like, God damn it!
How did you fuck this up again, Tobias?
He's like, I forgot.
I like being a bird. Anyway. So, these spores fall to Earth. They turn into these little snake things. They try to infect human brains by burrowing into the skull, and they basically devour the brain and replace it. They replace the head. But there are some failures here and there. For example, one burrows into a wolf's head instead, and one burrows into the arm of the protagonist, Shinichi. And, he is, like, wearing headphones at the time that it tries to attack him. It tries to go up his nose, and it wakes him up, and he has this little struggle with it, and he manages to tourniquet his arm when it burrows into that, so it doesn't manage to reach his brain. So, it infects his arm, and his arm becomes this parasite. And the parasites are... Actually, I would compare them more to symbiotes, and specifically the Marvel comic symbiotes that, like, Venom and Carnage come from, because they, you know, can transform their bodies into these sharp blades and in general, change the infected body part into any shape they want. So his arm can turn into these blades and stuff like that, and because the arm doesn't have control of his brain, they just kind of have to get along with each other begrudgingly. And
it's like a wacky 80s sitcom. Like, he's a normal high school boy, and he's a parasitic alien monster. Like, alien in question mark, like in a question mark, alien monster. Now they have to live together as roommates. Also, he's his hand. And they're other ones, they're trying to kill them. What's gonna happen in Parasite and the schoolboy? Not a porno.
So, Shinichi is like, well, I'll name you Migi, because Migi means right in Japanese, and you are my right hand. By the way, Shinichi is a teenager, and he spends at least a year with this thing on his hand. Does he jack off with Migi? Or does he learn to go left-handed?
I think he'd go left-handed. There's a certain thrill in going left-handed or going with the offhand. Not to make this weird.
It is.
I've never done it. I mean, I've heard. I presume. I've never jacked off. Nick, that's disgusting. Ew. You're gross. Let's talk about Barry Taylor something.
Maybe he tries to convince Migi to do it for him.
Well,
Migi is obsessed with reproduction, so...
Eventually, there's a point where he falls asleep for 4 hours every day. Boom. That's when he goes in and gets the job done.
Oh, yeah, good point.
And you know what? Migi's probably fine with it. Like, he does turn into a giant dick, like, in Chapter 2, so...
That is such a weird scene. This series is actually very off-the-cuff comedic at first. Before people just start dying all over the place, it is actually a pretty damn funny series to read, even if occasionally it may be unintentionally hilarious. For example, in order to demonstrate that the parasites are super dangerous and stuff, a lion just escapes from the zoo and starts murdering people. It just does. It randomly starts attacking people on the street and killing them until it comes across a guy who's got a parasite in his head, who then kills it immediately.
Yeah.
It just happens. So, yeah. From there, we get stuff like, well... there's stuff like a parasite manages to infect Shinichi's mom, so she dies.
Oh.
And from there, Shinichi ends up kind of going on this vengeance quest a little bit to kill a bunch of the parasites. He comes across a number of them. And there are a lot of different... The series is really built around these fight scenes between Shinichi and Migi and increasingly more powerful parasites.
Well, it's weird, too, because eventually it starts almost kind of forming these small little stories within itself that progress up to a point, and then they kind of stop for a little bit, and then it hits, like, an end point where there's, like, a main antagonist. Which was weird to me, because I had reached a point when reading the series that I thought it was done. I just said, like, I wasn't paying attention to the chapters or anything like that, and I was like, ah, this is like, the conclusion of it. And I was really happy about it, and I was like, oh, it keeps going. Oh, it keeps going for, like, 20 more chapters. Oh, I don't like this end. I really wish it had ended back there. It was actually kind of good when it ended there.
If it had ended when Shinichi met the antagonist the first time, as opposed to the third time, then it would have been a lot better, because the plot that we get that leads up to their second confrontation is dark and pretty stupid. The several chapters that lead up to the third confrontation is amazingly pointless and stupid. And then the two chapters after that are amazingly pointless and stupid. It is... The series has a strong foundation. It has pretty good art, because it's interesting to see the way that the morphing of the body during the fight scenes occurs. And even just during, like, casual scenes when either Shinichi or this one other character that we get introduced to later on, how they interact with their parasites and while they're, you know, bending their body in weird ways and stuff. But other than that, the series has a shit plot and really bad characters, I think.
There isn't even really a plot to the series beyond there are parasites, go. And that's it, because this essentially is almost like an existential exploration manga. Like, the entire purpose of not only the humans, but the parasites, is just to answer the question, why are we here? And it does answer that question in a couple different ways. The most notable one that I kind of liked was where I thought the series was going to end, and it's like, no, I'm going to go longer and give you more of an answer. I was like, no, you had it right. There is no answer. Just enjoy life. Ah, oh, fuck. God damn it.
But, we have to talk about how important it is to be human. Oh, we have to have this one guy have to say, oh, but humans are the real monsters because they destroy the Earth. And so the parasites need to clear out humanity. But that doesn't matter because humans have will to live. And there is another guy who says that he is the only human that acts the way humans are naturally meant to, which is killing each other. And everyone else is a pretender, and so humans are the real monster. Except that the parasites are the real monster, because they are cruel and awful people.
It's interesting, at least I found interesting at points, where, because early on you get this impression like, alright, this thing has infected Shinichi, it's part of this, you know, these parasites that are killing people, because that's all they do at the start of it. They kill people, and that's when the series feels like a horror manga, because there's just shots of these monsters eating people, cutting them to pieces, a lot of murder. And that's the impression you get, is like, okay, he has this thing in him, eventually it's going to also become a monster. Like, that was my impression going into it. I was like, hey, right, it's going to be something like that, but it doesn't. Like, Migi eventually starts to form like a very cool relationship with him, because he goes into it in a parasitic way. He's like, look, we both kind of need each other to survive at this point. Like, you can't really change that I've gotten to you. And now in the menu, I'm actually only interested in our mutual self-preservation. So I'm not actually going to fuck with you. Like, I'm not going to do something that's going to cause you to want to kill me, because there's nothing for me to gain from that, you know?
Also, we're friends by...
Yeah. So, I mean, he spends a lot of the series kind of trying to, like, argue with Shinichi. Like, look, I know you don't want to do this, but to be fair, like, that person knows who we are. We can't let that person... Like, there's a couple moral questions.
We should totes kill that guy, Shinichi. And Shinichi is like, no, even though I am growing increasingly cold and monstrous, suddenly I am really freaked out about this. And he's a little bit inconsistent with his character changes and stuff.
To a certain point, I think so, that there was a part, and I may have just been reading too much into this, but they mentioned at one point the teacher girl, I forget what her name is.
Reiko,
I guess, yeah.
The female.
The one with the kid.
Parasite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She mentions, after seeing at one point, like, oh, it looks like they're merging. And that's basically when he does, like, his time skip sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. After that point, I noticed it becoming more and more infrequent which one would kind of have a certain personality at points. I didn't know if it was intentional or not to say that their, you know, their personalities were starting to intermix with each other. Because there are points where Shinichi, like, really acted like he was kind of a horrifying monster at points, or really had just an attitude of like, I'm the only person that matters. And there were points when Migi kind of felt like he was having sympathy for others, which is, you know, contrary to where it was at the beginning, when he's like, I'm incapable of fucking your crazy human emotion of sympathy. Why? It's not me and it's dead. Who gives a fuck?
Right.
So I may have been reading into that maybe their personalities were starting to blend as a part of that merger, but there are also points where it does really feel like they're not entirely consistent with how this kid's acting. But I didn't mind it, I guess. I think I enjoyed the series more than you did, based off of how you're talking about it.
It's worse than I remember it.
But I won't say I love this series. I think that there are good points to it and points that I enjoyed, just nothing that I was like, this was a great part or anything like that. Just points that I sat back and I was like, this is interesting. I can kind of get into this. And small things it does that I like, which, like, for example, as a horror-esque series, doesn't feel the need to just murder everything with a face that happens to be in the series. Like, there is occasional senseless killing, but there are a lot of times where parasites or people with parasites will encounter humans along their way that they don't kill them. Maybe they try to, or maybe it's just a passerby, but I feel like in a lot of other series, Cough Terraformers, those characters would just been murdered. They would just been like, hold on, I have a monster here and a person that's alive, and this thing can just punch its face and explode it, even if it serves no purpose? Well, of course they will.
In general, the parasites only kill people either if they are going to eat them, or if they have been discovered.
Yeah.
So.
Now, there are a few that do kind of just continue to kill because they grow and adapt in a more evil way, but it is sort of a series that ultimately, if you care about the question of, like, man and nature and why are we here, there are arguments in it that I think you might find interesting. It's not a series that's going to answer anything for you, especially because even though it has an answer for itself, which I feel is almost counterproductive to the entire question, it's very set in, like, ah, well, I have the answer to it. There's very little, like, combating points. Almost anyone else who has an idea on what they think the answer to life is are usually crazy assholes.
Mm-hmm.
But I there's a point. I don't want to spoil anything too much. But it's also not that long of a series to read, so again.
Yeah, it's 9 volumes long. But like I said, I read this in like a few hours, honestly. Both times that I've read the series through, it's a very cinematic kind of series in terms of artistic style during the action scenes and stuff, so it's not very dialogue heavy, and what dialogue there is not particularly thick. The slowest parts to get through are whenever someone is just kind of waxing philosophical, and those are actually shorter to get through than you might suspect too.
Yeah. But there's a scene about 40 chapters or so in, and I legitimately thought it was the ending when I was reading it. It involves the teacher, there's a scene in a park, she has a baby, and it has this element of seeming final, because she, to what I understood, was kind of the main antagonist of the series. There is actually someone else beyond her who's actually combative.
To provide some context, the woman Reiko is one of the first parasites that we're introduced to, other than Migi. And she introduces herself to them after Migi and Shinichi have had to fight a couple of parasites already. Parasites have the ability to actually sense each other. And so they're kind of, you know, worried about what's going to happen and stuff, because she becomes a teacher at Shinichi's school. But she, like, you know, kind of calls him after class and says, "Hey, meet me here. No, I'm not going to hurt anyone. We can meet in public if you want. And, you know, I don't want to expose myself." And she introduces him to this other guy, and he's like, "We had sex." And she kind of freaks out about this a bit. And then she says, "Yeah, we had sex. I'm pregnant. And the child that I'm having is human. So I'm curious about, you know, what this is like," basically. And she pops up throughout the series and is basically the longest recurring character out of the parasites in the whole series. And, you know, it's just like, you know, there are these guys, she's occasionally keeping tabs on Shinichi, Shinichi's trying to find her, there are other characters that are trying to track her down, she has disagreements with the other parasites because she has her own interpretations of how they should interact with humanity and stuff, and then we get to the end where you were talking about her.
Yeah, so there's basically, it all comes down to the shutout. What was kind of very interesting about her is she was the first parasite that Shinichi met that wasn't about immediately just killing the other parasite. Basically, any time before this that he encountered one, they had a fight to death immediately, but she was one who kind of presented this idea of, like, no, we can kind of coexist. And, you know, her logic kind of bounces up and down throughout the series from the point of being like, oh, okay, that's interesting, to be like, what the fuck is this? I don't understand what she's doing anymore. But she has this thing. Her big element is that she is actually a parasite who has created life, and she doesn't exactly know how to take care of a child. She is
very good at getting it to stop crying.
Yes, she screams bloody murder at it. She also takes it to, like, a college course with, like, it's such a weird scene. He's like talking about how bees will protect their hive, but, like, really it's all about them wanting to kill their own family or something like that, and he's
fitting a semester's worth of debates into, like, 5 minutes. It's the most exposition-y, this is the philosophical discussion that the entire manga is about dialogue ever.
And what's great about it is a lot of it, like, is about how, like, mother would eventually, like, kill the child or something. Like, basically, like, it's you know, a mother would kill its child or something like that, or along those lines of, like, it's not, you know, everything's about self-preservation. And the rest of the class is like, look at the baby! Look at the baby here!
especially because it's implied that the lecture's been going on for some time, and they're just now saying, like, oh, she's got a baby, wow!
This is interesting. But anyway, to the point, there's a scene where they meet in the park, and it has this element of being very final, because going into it, Shinichi, like, calls his dad. He's like, Dad, someone's coming after me. You need to get out of the house. I apologize for everything I've done for you, but please trust me as your son. And, like, his dad believes him, leaves the house. His girlfriend character is like, I know you have to come back to me. Like, promise me you'll come back. And, like, the whole thing is just saying trust him, believe him, he'll come back. And he shows up at this park. There's this big showdown where the government's essentially finally really revealed that these parasite things exist and they have an identity.
Yeah, the one competent character in the entire series basically has rounded up a force in order to track down the suspicions of this one guy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they've got a whole bunch of men with pistols aimed at her and stuff, and he's, like, seriously, this one police captain is, like, the only competent side character in the fucking series.
And they basically see her, and they just start firing on her. And the entire time, she's just, like, kind of knocking their bullets away, because she doesn't care, but she's protecting the baby. And her whole thing is she's just continuously walking towards Shinichi, and kind of hands in the baby, and she sits there, and she's like, I've been spending my entire life trying to figure out what the meaning behind all of this is, and I thought I've had the answer a couple times, but all it does is provoke more questions, and I think I finally realized I'm not... Like, I would never be satisfied by my answer, and it's pointless to keep looking for it. So, you know, here's what I've kind of discovered about my life. I feel like this is the only important thing I have, this child. You know, here you go. And then she dies. Yeah. And it's kind of like this, not like a sad scene, but it is this weird scene, because this was kind of a differing viewpoint to Shinichi's that he's now kind of accepting. Like, you know, Miki to this point, but generally anytime they ran into a parasite that was an antagonist to them anyway, they solved it by killing them. You know, through a battle or something like that. So it was just this interesting way for things to kind of end. And it was like, oh, this is a moment for Shinichi to kind of reflect on things, come to his own conclusions about his life, for Migi to come to his own conclusions, and everything kind of wraps up, and he does return home after a very dangerous scenario, because he almost did die during this whole endeavor from another one of the parasites.
Right.
But then it keeps going on for like another 20 chapters, and it just gets weirder, and I'm like, oh, we didn't need this. You could have stopped there, I feel like.
I think that we could spend a good chunk of this later on shitting on the last quarter of the series or so, because it's entirely pointless and stupid.
The last chapter in general,
we'll get into that. But I would have liked the series a lot more, I'll agree, if it had ended at this point. I don't think I would have been entirely positive on it at all. But... I mean, the series is weird because it's really sexist. I swear, like, there are, like, three female roles in the series. Having the hots for Shinichi, being captured / killed, and being an over-worried motherly figure. Like, that is basically it.
I'm trying to think of the female characters in this. There's his girlfriend, the girl who wants to be his girlfriend, his mom, and the mother.
There is, like, another character. There are three characters that end up having crushes on Shinichi, because there's also the one that meets him while he has traveled to where his parents were on vacation.
Oh, that's right. There was that girl, too. Like, the little
child or
whatever he's saying. Oh, yeah.
And there's also another motherly character that encounters him at that time, and she acts all overbearingly motherly. His mom is paranoid about everything. And then there's this whole thing about Reiko, because she is a mother and stuff. It's basically, if you fall, you are a sexual, you know, cat until you either die or you have a kid, and then the kid defines all that you are as a person. That is what what Parasite's interpretation of a woman seemingly is. Because Reiko is the one divergent parasite in the series, other than the ones that are failed parasites, and it is because she has a kid. And it's frustrating because of that. I mean, if there were more diverse female characters in the series, it would not be as nearly as much of a problem, and it would have probably been a much more interesting little story if you know did not say, oh, this is what women are. You know, they have a mother, and then their whole world revolves around the kid, and that's it.
Because I would say, I mean, that's really only a story you could tell with a mother, because it's not, they're the ones who are actually are going to carry and then give birth to a child. So, I mean, you could still tell a parent-child story with a father figure, but it has a lot more significance for a mother. But you're right in that there really aren't any other female characters that have a major role outside of being doting on Shinichi or wanting to have a, you know, date him.
I mean, in fairness, I would say this manga is a product of, you know, the culture that it was written in, because this series ran in the late 80s and early 90s, and it was in Japan. So, oh, God. And also, on top of that, I had a difficult time getting into Shinichi's character, because the series goes back and forth between the issue of him becoming a monster and inhuman as he and Migi grow into one more and more one entity than two separate ones, because that directly interferes with the personal grudges that he should have against the parasites, because, you know, they kill his mother, they kill his friends. There's a girl that gets close to him because she has a crush on him, until, because he is starting to trust her and reveal his secret to her, because of that, in a way, it's his fault, she dies. But then, you know, after they've died, he's like, he freaks out over his mom, but then shortly after he discovers that, that's when Migi basically has to start modifying his body structure. Basically, he gets stabbed at the chest, Migi goes into his body, and so they grow more and more into one person, and so his personality starts changing immediately. So there's, like, very little discussion of, oh, I want to kill the parasites after, you know, the initial reaction to all that. And then Kana, the girl that has a crush on him, she dies. And they make a big deal of him not crying at her funeral. It all eventually comes together at the very end, because Shinichi is able to actually, you know, express more human emotion right after the whole thing with Reiko is wrapped up.
And that's, again, that was why it was such a great endpoint for her, because I was like, oh, this is shown that he's changed. Because there's also this significant moment where he's basically become like a superhuman now, because Migi's cells have infected his entire body now. They're all over. So he's not just having like the super razor arm, he's also super fast, super strong, super senses. And there's a point where he's like, oh, here's something really quiet. And he like fucking jumps into traffic and there's a dying dog. And he picks the dog up and he's like, oh, it's dying, it's sad, I want to make sure its last moments are with someone. And the dog dies and he's like, oh. And he throws it in the trash because he's become emotionless and detached. So the girl he likes is like, that's horrible, you're a monster. And he realizes what he's done, how he's becoming distant. And he then gets the dog out of the trash and buries it. And it's this big conflicting moment for himself where he's like, am I becoming like me? Am I becoming like this parasite?
Yeah, and it was frustrating to me because those two things get into each other's way. Mm-hmm. That I agree with you. Like that point we're talking about would have been a very good ending point, because it would have actually redeemed a lot of that, at least. I don't think it would have been an entirely good conclusion to that, but it would have helped to salvage the problems that I had with that whole build up to it. Because, you know, like I said, the personal grudges and the am I a human, am I a monster, blah 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 stuff get in each other's way so much.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a small point to the I can't even remember the fucking character's name, Mr. A, I think it is.
Yeah,
basically
the first major villain that they fight, I guess.
Yeah, there is like a small point to when he beats him, because basically he beats him in a way that he's poisoned the body. Everything's
that's
dying.
That's not Mr. A. That's Goto. That's Goto. Goto.
Yeah, sorry, I mixed up some of the characters' names.
Goto is the final antagonist.
Yeah, he's killed Gota, or at least all the parasites are kind of breaking apart, but he's staying there and they're starting to reform. And basically, it's like a video game. Like, I felt like it was like a Walking Dead or a Telltale game or something like that, because it's very bluntly put out. Like, you have the choice.
Mash A in order to reform Migi.
But it's very much like, you know, like you have option one or option two. You can let the parasite reform, who knows what will happen, or you can choose to kill it off entirely. And the question's very bluntly posed to him. Those are your two choices.
Shinichi's like,
you have to pick one. Like, Miggy's like, yeah, it's you can't just stand here,
motherfucker.
Yeah, he's like, I burn it all and take its money. But he does have to choose, and it actually is kind of interesting the way he goes about it, because he wants to say, like, it's all about life. Who am I to say something doesn't deserve to live? He starts to walk away, and he's like, but I'm
human. How can I not want to kill this thing, basically?
Yeah, and he's like, like a parasite, in the interest of my self-preservation, I don't want you to ever come back after my family. And he goes back and kills it. Spoilers.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
I think that that's something that is very easy to relate. That is does. There are moments in this series that are really good, like moments that I do like. I do like the whole, I don't know if I should kill the thing because I have learned, you know, through my relationship with Migi, that their lives are precious. Yeah. But seriously, that guy's going to come and kill a whole bunch of people that I care about, so fuck him.
Yeah, and he's also sitting there wondering, like, well, maybe he won't be able to reform. Like, he may not be able to survive. Because that's also a question on it, too. Like, you know, you could just leave it here and kind of see what happens, but can you take that risk? And Migi doesn't even make the, you know, doesn't push him into either choice, too. Migi is ultimately like kind of an observer in this. He's like, look, you're the one in control. It's your decision. I'll support you either way, but you know, you make the choice. So it's cool in that regards. And that's the penultimate chapter, I think, or maybe the
almost third penultimate. Third to last.
The last chapter, though, is just awful.
Well, let's talk about the last quarter of the series. Because after Reiko dies, then we get this whole thing, because it's been building up that there is this organization of parasites that have been forming, where basically they're set up these things called restaurants, which are basically their feeding grounds. They're organized ways of getting food and stuff so that, you know, in each of them is not having to track down one human occasionally so that they can eat. So they're organizing and stuff, and one of the things that they're doing is they actually are backing, they're getting into human politics. They're backing this mayor so that they can basically start changing the world. It's implied that they want to change the world in such a way that they, the parasites, will be able to be preserved. So they back this mayor who is all about preserving the environment and stuff, which makes sense. Because, like, oh, you know, we have to make sure that the world is able to continue to you know, we're able to continue to subsist off of it, so we need to make environmental changes and stuff. Bad pollution and so on. And that actually ends up tying into how Shinichi eventually kills Goto, is because there's trash, and he's poisoned when Shinichi gets a rusty rod and stabs him, and it poisons him.
Yes.
Although the explanation for the trash being exactly there is, it is because they dumped it there for some reason.
It was like, so mankind's fucking laziness saved us all.
Yeah, it turns out...
So we should pollute, just in case.
Just in case more parasites show up, let's leave heaps of poisonous trash everywhere. Oh, God, what a weird series. Anyway, so after the one police captain guy has discovered this, he basically gets in contact with the military and is like, okay, these are all where all these aliens are and stuff. So we need to go and kill them. We need to fucking exterminate this invading force. And they act like fucking psychopaths while doing so.
Yeah, there's like a giant military force, and like, you're like, oh, this isn't gonna work.
What was the name of like the major from Avatar? It basically, that guy is their leader.
Oh, yeah, fucking...
The guy who is like...
Who has a cup that's like America on it or something like that. He's like sipping coffee like, I love destroying cultures.
He's like, I've got... My robot's gonna have a combat knife on it, bitch.
Why wouldn't it?
Oh, God, that guy's a psychopath. And actually, what's really funny is they actually recruit a psychopath. They recruit the most evil fucking person on the entire goddamn planet. This guy who... It's established that there are some people that, for whatever reason, are able to detect the existence of parasites. Kana seemingly has some sixth sense that allows her to radar find these people. And it's actually established that she can do it in a way that is very similar to the way the parasites can detect each other. It's never explained why.
Yeah.
It's a plot device. and that's why Shinichi ends up trusting her, which is why she dies. Anyhow. But this one guy can says he thinks he can just do it because he's he knows humans in a weird way, because he fucking likes to kill them and cut them up and cut them open and cut their heads off and then fuck the headless ones and eat them while he's fucking them. This guy is the most evil thing ever.
We should know, the way he's introduced to us too is like, we find him in a prison, they put him in like a one of those like two-way mirror kind of rooms, and he gets to look at five people and like determine whether or not they're parasites or not. The second person he meets is a woman, and he immediately just starts jacking off in front of her.
Yeah,
that's how we're introduced to this character.
So he, for some reason, has the ability not only to detect if someone is human or not, and if it were just if you could detect if they were human or not, that would make sense, but he also can claims if that he can tell if someone can also detect parasites or not, which is never followed up on. I don't even know why they bother with that, because
there's a lot of small plot points that don't get followed up on.
There's a lot of things.
Does Uda ever have like a final moment or anything like that?
No.
Like, he just stops appearing.
He just stops showing up because there was nothing left for him to do. There are characters that seem like they're being built up for something, and then they just stop showing up eventually. It's annoying.
Like, his dad never comes into play, really, in anything. There's just things that don't really serve a purpose.
That girl that he meets when he goes... That's why you forgot about her. The girl that he meets when he goes to find his parents and stuff. She stops showing up. Just...
He's like, well, he's not over there anymore, so why would she show up?
Yeah. It's, like I said, not the strongest plot ever. But anyway, so this guy is introduced. And so he is introduced as a very valuable tool for the military because of his ability to detect them and stuff. Here's the thing. In, like, Chapter 10, rumors are spreading around that these head monster things exist, and so people start, you know, in paranoia, plucking the hair off of each other's heads, and it turns out that this actually works, because if you pluck an aspect of the parasite off, it starts to react, it wriggles around and stuff. It's basically like the thing where, you know, they have this means of detecting them. And the police chief guy does this. Like, right before they go and they confront Reiko, he plucks hair from each of his, you know, direct subordinates' heads, and is like, okay, it seems like we're all human. He trusts in this method.
Yes.
They can detect humans this way. It actually works. But they need this psychopath guy.
No one ever just plucks hairs from anyone's head in a moment where it'd be really, really helpful. There's a point where Reiko is surrounded by three parasites, and what she does, like, this crazy ass plan to essentially like run into the city with half of her face, which is a hilarious scene.
It's hilarious because she's laughing while she's doing
it. She just has half a head, and she's like she's running through the fucking city, and everyone's like, oh my god, what's happening? But she gets cornered, and everyone's like, there, that's the woman we saw doing it. And like a police officer is like, stop there! And she turns, and she's got her head back. She's like formed it back up, and she's changed her face. And she's like, "I didn't do anything." And they're like, "You weren't just a screaming mouth monster." No. And the officer's like, "Well, I could just pluck one hair from your head and prove if you're right or not." But these other people who saw, like these 38 people who saw you do it, must be crazy. You guys are crazy.
Now, on top of this, they also have a more subtle method of detecting this, because obviously, you know, if you reach towards someone's head and, you know, pluck hair from them, they're going to be like, oh, they're trying to detect if I'm human or not. Blah.
Yeah.
So the other method they have is to walk them past an X-ray screen, and they do this by, like, saying, oh, you know, they go into this facility where there are all these aliens who are supporting their political candidate and stuff, and they're like, okay, so there is a sniper on the roof, you guys, but, you know, don't panic. You know, we're going to evacuate you, and you're going to do it in such a way that, you know, we'll go in small groups with, you know, two soldiers escorting you. And if we do this in small groups, then, you know, we'll minimize the chance that the sniper will catch you. Will detect us, basically. So they go along with this, and they walk them past this X-ray screen. And they aren't sure if it's going to work at first, but then they see an alien, and it's like, okay, that works too. So, again, the psychopath who can detect aliens is redundant. They don't need him. Now, they end up having to stuff breaks down and they end up having to go inside of the facility. The military chief basically says, like, I think that I can tell which ones are aliens or not based on how they're behaving, and by trial and error now. Again, the alien's redundant. The alien detection guy is redundant. Then, they just reach a point where they're like, okay, if you see someone above the first floor, they are an alien. Shoot them. They don't need the psychopath to detect them. So, of course, the cop who is escorting him, the guy says, hey, if there's something that goes wrong, I want to be able to get away, so at least uncuff me. And he does! They are surrounded by guns in a situation of panic. They're... Why would you uncuff the psychopath who rapes and fucks corpses?
Yeah, like, it's not like this is a dude who's like, oh, I got picked up for petty larceny. Like, he's like a committed murder monster.
So they just fucking let him do that. So, of course, at the end of everything, the guy who is guarding him, and of course there's only one guy guarding him, he gets distracted by a mountain of corpses that Goto has killed. The guy gets a gun and shoots him and gets away. So, when the series should be over, and all of the aliens are now dead, as far as we know, except for Migi and another failed parasite that he meets and gets along with.
They note other ones have survived as well, but like Reiko, they've also come to just adapt to things and learn to eat human food.
Basically, the threat to humanity is over. The plot is done.
Yeah, they noted, like, at this point, from now on forward, you wouldn't even know if someone's a parasite unless you, like, activated their powers unconsciously, because otherwise they're not going to use them.
So the plot is done.
Yes.
It's over.
It's done. He's learned his lesson about life. He talks about Axis philosophic a little bit.
A year has gone by. Shinichi and his girlfriend are going to college. Things are cool.
Migi has turned to him in a dream and said, I'm going to be going away for... Basically, he also does the ending to her where he's like, the words are getting farther and farther apart. But he disappears. Like, Migi gives him, like, a goodbye moment. That has a really cheesy ending because he's like, I chose to do this in a dream because that way you'll think that all of this was a dream and you'll forget about me. Bye.
No, I won't.
And then Migi wakes up and he's like, how can I forget about you, my parasite bro? Which I was like, yeah, I get the friendship. It's just a weird thing in this kind of series where it'd be like, you were my bro, monster hand.
So the psychopath tracks Shinichi down and kidnaps his girlfriend. And they have this showdown on the roof after he kills two more innocent people, just slash them across the throat with the sharpest knife ever. And they have this showdown. And so he's like, I am the only human who listens to the urge to kill other humans. Everyone else is wearing a mask. And then he threatens to kill Murano, Shinichi's girlfriend. Shinichi is like, I still have superhuman strength, so I'll just rush him and stop him and save her. And he throws Murano off the roof. Shinichi is like, it's still cool. I'll wreck the guy with my left hand and catch Murano with my right. And then he stabs the knife right through his arm. With the, again, sharpest knife ever. So Shinichi caves his face in, but oh, he was too slow to catch Murano.
Bummer.
But then he did catch her! And it's like, oh, did Migi awaken and extend to catch her? Does Murano now finally know his secret? Which, by the way, why the fuck did Shinichi never trust her with his secret? He told a random detective who was totally going to spill the beans on his ass.
It was essentially because Migi, though for the most part, is always like, yeah, I'm following your orders. He was always very clear. He's like, you know, if you tell anybody, we have to kill them, right? And he couldn't trust that Migi wouldn't just do it, since Migi does control his right arm.
But then they let the detective go.
Yeah, at that point, you feel like he would tell her, especially after everything that happened. And he's like, look, I'm just going to tell you, I have this thing in my hand. I feel like at this point, you can kind of... It's in the news, all right? I feel like you probably should have put the pieces together anyway. But hey, here you go. I'm just going to tell you openly.
And after that is when they have the whole confrontation with Reiko, and Murano, like, comes to him at the end of it. So he's very emotionally vulnerable and stuff, and he still doesn't tell her!
Yeah.
Because Murano is there to be a hostage and be his emotional core and nothing else. because the series is kind of sexist. So, it's a very problematic series, I found, and it really distracted me from what good points there were to be had in it, which I felt overwhelmed the good parts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird series.
We've gone on about this for a very long time. I've got a lot of pent-up hatred for this one, it turns out.
Turns out, yeah. I would say that it's an interesting series. It's not a horror series. The closest it is body horror, really. If that weirds you out, then I can totally understand it. But honestly, I'm someone who doesn't care for body horror at all, but I didn't find it that bad in this series.
It's almost... it's a splatter film, really. There are times when the gore is, like, comedic.
Yeah, and it's also, like, I mean, not for nothing, but Mickey's really cute. He's kind of an adorable little buddy there. He's like this big, silly jellyfish or starfish thing.
At first, when he's drawn to appear more realistic, like there's more shading and stuff on his form, and he looks more blobbish and stuff, doesn't look quite right. But then later in the series, as the series goes on, he looks more cartoonish.
Yeah, he's definitely almost like a mascot. Like, I was like, I could do a children's cartoon on Saturday morning starring this thing. Oh, Mickey, the monster hand.
And people in the chat room were noting the fact that in order to... because the anime... despite the fact that this manga finished like 20 years ago, the anime version only just came out starting last year. And so kind of in a bit to, I guess, to promote like the DVD release or something like that, something along those lines, it actually had a crossover with fucking Fairy Tail.
Yeah, I was going to bring it up. I found that and I read it and I was like, well, this is strange.
It is really weird because Lucy gets Miggy, basically.
It's so uncalled. It makes sense. She's the butt monkey of the series, so of course she'd be burdened with it. And there are a couple amusing bits to it, like just the things that the hand's forcing her to do when everyone in Fairy Tail's reaction to it. But it's so strange. Like,
it's kind of funny because it's a running joke early on that Miggy is obsessed with wanting to see Shinichi and Murano have sex just to see what human reproduction is like in person. And he's like, no, that's weird. And so, at one point, Shinichi is getting horny, so Miggy transforms into the shape of a penis.
Yeah, like a giant dick.
That never happens ever again. He never transforms to reflect Shinichi's emotional state after that. It's just a one-off sight gag. But, so, you would think that at some point in the crossover, he would be like, you should get naked. You should get naked and... you should walk around your apartment in a towel.
Yeah.
That's like, the explanation for why she's perpetually in these fan service segments.
Yeah, in my headcanon, this is actually a legitimate piece of the series, and from thenceforward, I'm always going to wonder, like, why didn't Miggy help her there, Nick? She's being attacked by Brenda, she didn't do anything. But yeah, it is, if you're very curious, you can check that out. It's absurdly strange and ends in a very stupid way, but it was somewhat amusing in its own way. But, I do kind of... there's parts of the series I definitely enjoyed. Again, it's not horror, but it's almost like a pseudo, like kind of a psychological series. It only has its viewpoint. It doesn't like pose the question and kind of leave it for your interpretation. It gives you an answer,
If it does leave it open to interpretation, it is asking the most obvious questions, and is just like, I am being deep. And it's just like, shut up.
There are times it does have, like, thought-provoking moments and things like that, and for that, I did enjoy it. Those are the moments where I really did kind of get invested and I really enjoyed it. But as you said, and we pointed out several times, they're just weird, long points of stories that just aren't particularly good. There's a real kind of up and down swing as to whether or not you're going to enjoy anyone. None of the characters outside of Miggy for me were particularly enjoyable all the way through. There's a lot of like characters that just seem to have relevance and then just don't anymore. Like we did Shinichi's dad or Uda, just characters who were there, and you're like, I guess we won't do anything with this. I guess that was done. And then it has just an awful final chapter. Like it has a kind of cool moment where Miggy saves her, and they have like kind of like one last final bro moment at the very end. But it's such an unnecessary like end to it, with an entire discussion about what this dude feels like being a human is. That feels entirely superfluous and unnecessary after we've had basically two final closures as to that question already. And doesn't add anything new to it. It's just some dude with a viewpoint that I think even the most fucking emo-starved 12-year-old kid would be like, well, this is fucking ridiculous. Like, no one's buying into this bullshit. So, I mean, that's bad. But I still feel like there's some, like, enough good bits to it that I feel like if you're in for this kind of series, if this seems intriguing to you, if you have like a week or so that you want to kind of just kill some time going through this series, you will get some enjoyment. Or I feel like a lot of people can get enjoyment out of this. It's just not a great series by any stretch of the imagination. There's nothing in this that I feel is spectacular. It's just enjoyable for me.
And I am mostly in agreement with you. I think that this, in spite of how much I dislike a lot of it, there are some parts that are kind of good. The art, I like I said, is actually very interesting to see, and I think that it is worth checking out, if only because of that, because it does that sort of combat in a different way than a lot of series do. It's interesting to actually to see, we haven't really touched too much on it, it's interesting to see the way that Migi and Shinichi fight, and the way that their relationship affects their combat and gives them an advantage, because they are two entities working as one, and despite the fact that they, you know, are throwing out these hideously powerful, you know, swarms of tentacle blades and stuff like that, oftentimes they'll win because the other parasite isn't paying attention when Shinichi fucking shivs their ass.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see that stuff.
There actually was, I forgot to mention, there was a fight I actually really enjoyed where he fights the first multi-parasite person. And essentially, like, this dude has like five different parasites working inside of him that all have launching attacks, so he has to use this strategy of basically running really far in a large arc to convince the different parasites, which are uncoordinated, that he basically screws with their depth perception, jumps in between them, and then just, like, beheads the guy in, like, this one cool kind of, like, final moment. And I thought it was a really innovative way to kind of do that fight scene.
So, I mean, there's good stuff, and like I said, I think you can read it very quickly, so it's not going to waste a whole lot of your time. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, we've been going on about this quite long enough. I did not think we were going to talk about this for this long, so let's get into the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap.
You thought we'd have a short episode, Nick.
I was a fool.
It's like, you like to dream.
Let's start off with Black Clover, page 35, The Strongest Guy. Jeez, what a title. So Asta's been abducted! Oh no! All the Magic Knights, except for Noelle, are like, oh well, we've got other stuff to do.
This is such assholes.
Noelle's like, we have to save him! They're like, nope, got other stuff to do. Mimosa starts healing Fuego Leon, and also Leopold is really beat up too. Mimosa's like, okay, I can do first aid, but we need to take him to the medical ward and stuff. And they're like, oh man, I can't believe that this happened. And some of the Silver Eagles are like, oh man, I can't believe the captain was this pathetic. He's so stupid.
It's like, I guess you're royal, so or like you're, you know, this is what happened when you make your military out of the nobility, like they're just gonna be haughty and shit, but they just have so much trouble comprehending a military organization. It's just like, one of our leaders went down, whatever, he's pathetic, what a loser. Like, who would do this?
So eventually Nozel, you know, cross braid guy.
I know it's his name.
It is such a stupid name, isn't it?
Nozel. I was talking to my brother about this the other day. It's a Fairly Odd Parents, Cosmo and a brother just called Schnozno. And it's like the same thing in my mind. I'm just thinking it's Noelle, but with a giant hook nose on her.
God. So, Nozel is like, you know, unless we win, our existence is pointless. And so it's like, yeah, he's gonna trash the reputation of the Crimson Lion Kings. And like, but because we were not even present at the fight, we are less than he is. And so it's like, oh, okay. So, I guess at that solid, it's like, oh, I better take this. Who the fuck is this guy? He's one of the other captains, I guess. I don't even fucking recognize him. Whatever. He's like, oh, you know, don't let your guard down. And he starts taking control and stuff. And Noah's like, oh, no, Asta. And we cut to where...
She's like, who knows when he'll be back?
Apparently in a couple chapters. So we cut to where the Dark Guild or whatever is the Order of the Eyes. I forget their exact name. They have kidnapped Asta. And they dump him in this, like, I guess, keep, abandoned keep in the middle of the woods. And some of them are kind of trash-talking with Radies, and he's like, shut up! And then the one who I guess was specifically interested in Asta and captured him takes her hood off to reveal that she's this girl with glasses. And she's like, oh, I know what you want. You want me to investigate every last inch of you and your grimoire and run all sorts of experiments on you, right? You want to be useful to my research, right? Which I like that, you know, very quickly establishing her creepy character traits of, you know, like wandering experiments, but thinking like, oh yeah, they really want me to do this. Oh yeah. It makes her seem proper scary, and she's drawn in such a way that she looks pretty mental.
So. And she has a unique design, because again, one of my issues with this series has been kind of characters look a lot alike, but this is a character I'm like, oh, she has like kind of a unique appearance, and it's a fun archetype to play with. I know we joke a lot about Mayuri, but it is, you know, kind of cool when you have a scientist character in the evil bad guy team. You could do a lot with it.
Mm-hmm. So Asta, of course, is really freaked out and is nervous about the situation. And they're like, okay, let's head into the keep. And then suddenly the fucking Wizard King shows up. And he's just like, hello, I've been waiting for you.
There was a hot moment here when I was reading this chapter where I was like, ah, so the Wizard King is in line with the villains of this series.
I thought so too.
And then immediately I was like, oh no, no, no!
So, yeah, they're like, oh my god, it's Julius Novacrono, the Wizard King! And he's like, oh, how is the capital? And they're like, why is he here? And they whip out their grimoires, die! And he just fucking holds his hands out with orbs of energy in them and wrecks the fuck out of two of them immediately.
He vaporizes them! They're not like, just defeated, they're dead, they're erased from existence.
They're like, oh my god, that's impossible. He's like, no, I killed them. It would have just been really difficult, you know, with numbers like these to actually hold back and restrain you. So, I killed them instead. He's like, holy shit, this guy is cold. So, yeah, more attacks, but he is just completely wrecking through them. One of the ones that summoned Vines earlier, he just destroys them immediately. Radies is freaking out. And the Wizard King says, you can't possibly have gone to kill without being prepared to be killed, right? He's scary! He's very scary! I do not for a minute believe that he won't eventually be a villain, because he's so scary. And Spatial Magic Guy is like, oh man, he's so powerful! My magic's already drained, oh no! Which I guess teleporting a whole lot takes it out of him.
Yeah, well, we teleport a lot of people. We did a lot of teleporting during the fights.
He teleported large groups a long distance twice, in addition to all the stuff he was doing during the actual fight as well. One of the cloaked ones, as well as the glasses girl, trying to fight as well. Specifically, the guy who used the wind drills earlier. The Wizard King moves really fast. At first, I thought he might have summoned mirror images, but no, he is moving Dragon Ball Z.
Shadow clones.
He's basically moving Dragon Ball Z style, where, you know, he moves so fast that, like, multiple copies of him appear, like, as after images and stuff. And they're like, how is he so fast? And he's like, okay, well, I think now that I've cut your numbers down, now I should be able to capture you. And he fucking freezes them in time.
Yeah, he uses fucking time-binding magic and just stops them from, like... Basically, he just puts him in, like, a stasis, and he just notes, he's like, and now you should all live in one unending moment. And you're like, oh, what the fuck? Did he just basically kill them? Or is he like, no, you'll be in prison for a little bit, and then I'll do something.
I mean, there's no way that they would not have had, you know, the new character uncloak herself just to kill her off.
Would they, Nick? So. I said the exact same thing to myself, and after this chapter, I'm not entirely sure if that's the case.
So anyway, yeah, with Asta's captor now disabled, Asta's freed, and so the Wizard King's like, oh, hello, Asta, and Asta's like, wide-eyed, like, oh man, this guy's so powerful, still freaking out, and so he says, oh, you know, this is what you're aiming for, right, to become Wizard King? Well, in that case, don't look away, watch carefully, this is only a small fraction of what you'll have to surpass, and that's the end of the chapter. I thought this was actually, I mean, this was surprising, But, I mean, I guess that there weren't too many other ways that the last chapter could have resulted in other than the Wizard King showing up to save Asta. I am very surprised that he just immediately shit all over the new villain group, though. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen from here.
Oh, this was just an awful chapter for me. I've been trying to maintain positive, like a positive attitude on this for a while, but this is the chapter that I feel like I was mentioning this before the show. Like I feel like I was almost ready to just read Scanlations because I kind of just need to see what happens in the next chapter. Because at this moment, I'm like, yeah, what happens next chapter could ultimately undo a lot of the negative thoughts I have about this series right now. But it just annoys me to no end that they built this like tension only to have the Wizard King show up and just end all of it immediately. I was like, why did you introduce a villain group? Why did you give them a name? Why did you start introducing personalities and unique powers to them if he just kills them all in one chapter?
Last night, the Shield interfered in the match and allowed CM Punk to retain the championship. Now John Cena's going to take all of them on 1-on-3. Ding, ding, ding! John Cena won! He beat the Shield immediately!
You know what? We use those two references a lot. This is one of the more people understand. It would be like if you were watching Empire Strikes Back and you've gotten to the end of it and Han's been frozen in carbonite, Luke's lost his hand, the Empire has truly just like really put a stranglehold on the Jedi or on the Rebels, and then at the end of it, like it's about to close the credits, and then it jumps back up and Luke Skywalker, or no, fucking Yoda has just snuck into the fucking Death Star and he just cuts Emperor Palpatine's head right the fuck off. He just fucking straight up murders him and he just like, I don't know, cripples Darth Vader or something too. And you're like, credits. And you're like, well, wait! No! We had a moment there where you were really setting up that things looked bad and you just stopped.
Teabagging your corpse, I am. Yes.
Not so hard now. You don't have a senate to throw at me, do you? It's just like, I don't know. I don't know what the point of anything is. I feel like there was no point to this entire arc now. Like,
it is definitely going to depend on what happens from here.
Like, I still don't grasp what the plot of Black Clover is. We know that somewhere out there, there is some evil guy who seems to have a connection to the Golden Dawn. We don't know much about him, and I thought this was the connection to slowly lead into that. Like, we were going to start getting our Akatsutsi or whatever, essentially.
You're right. I figured... It seems like, you know, a couple chapters ago, it was like, oh man, you know, they killed Fuego Leon, you know, this group is serious. And then they captured Asta, and we were like, well, what's going to happen now, then? Because how long can the main character be captured? And turns out, no time at all. But that then completely...
It takes... Like, I'm like, what was the point of the whole thing in town, like, to introduce us to the other captains, essentially, because there's no real end point to it now, because all the villain group is dead. If they had goals, they either completed them, or they didn't, but it doesn't seem to matter, because the Wizard King solved that problem, it seems.
Well, yeah, I mean, I say, like, well, presumably they're going to escape somehow, and, you know, still be a thing, but even so, you've had your super awesome villain group, who wrecked one of the captains. We still don't know who actually killed Fuego Leon.
Who is not dead, by the way. They noted that again.
Right. They're basically like, he's probably going to make it. We just, you know, need to rush him to the hospital, basically. But they still have not revealed who actually took him out. So, like, the strongest member associated with this group still has not been revealed. But even so, there was, you know, a really big reveal for the spatial magic user. We just introduced this guy. This girl. We got to know Rady's personality and stuff, and, you know, got to know him as character over the course of his fight with Fuego Leon and so on. And then, yeah, the Wizard King just shows up and completely stomps all over them and makes them completely pointless and stupid. So if they ever show up again, it would be less like, well, this fight would be over in an instant if the Wizard King showed up.
And it makes you question why the Wizard King, because he knew to come here. Like, he knew to show up here. Whether he knew Asta was there, like, it was anything involved with that at all, we don't know. But again, it was one of those things, like, when... I mean, I guess we'll find out more about the Wizard King, but it's one of those things, like, why is he in the town just to stop any of this from happening, period? But I feel like next week and, like, the next couple weeks, which is very important because that'll kind of establish what the purpose of this, if any, you know, there is. But the one thing from this I still am really annoyed about, I am fucking tired of hearing about how Asta is awesome, how Asta has rivals, how Asta has a lot to live for to become the Wizard King. I'm tired of it. I'm so tired of fucking characters saying anything to Asta about what his future does, because it matters. None of it fucking leaves an impact on me. I'm so tired of being told Asta's got big things for him and he's super important and all these characters want to be his rival. It's just annoying the shit out of me every time it happens now.
Yeah.
Like, this is a character really needs to start showing me that he's supposed to be admirable, as opposed to everyone in the fucking universe telling me that his super awesome OC is great, guys. No, you don't get it.
No, it's cool, man. Willis has two Digimon.
Two Digimon. And he has two swords that can repair magic. Right. Like, I'm like, look, you can do something good with this character. Just stop telling me how fucking great he's going to be.
Next chapter, Asta's gonna get to kiss both Noelle and Mimosa on the cheek. Oh, God. Yeah, that's gonna do it. Let's move on to Bleach. Bleach! God damn it. Chapter 648, The Theater Suicide Scene 2. Yay. More multi.
Which starts with Asta Noctlavar, of course.
Right. He runs into Ichigo, and Ichigo's like, what happened to Grimmjow? He's sleeping over there. And Ichigo's like, did Grimmjow lose?
Let's not talk about winning or losing. By the way, my name's Asta Noctlavar. Like, well, I didn't ask you.
Okay, and so they start to have this showdown, but then it's like, boom, feeling of ominousness, and, like, darkness descends over the entire landscape, and it freaks out everyone, and Ganju's like, oh, it got dark and cold all of a sudden. Chad's like, no, the temperature didn't drop, and it didn't get dark. This is the chills. He's like, how the fuck can you tell the difference? It feels cold, right? Whatever.
He's like, my hand tells me. It's a new power my hand has. As you know, I'm of course half Quincy. Right? No, we're not retconning this hand thing again.
God damn it. So yeah, everyone's like, oh man, no, it's crazy. And Ichigo's like, this spiritual pressure, is it Captain Kyoraku's? You weren't fucking there when Kyoraku fought! Fuck you, Ichigo! You don't know the difference to that! You weren't there when he fought! Fuck you! You don't know what a spiritual pressure feels like.
Oh shit, you got mad.
Such a goddamn, it's like, I know this fucking because. He wasn't there when he fought Stark. The only time he felt Kyoraku fighting was when all the captains were fighting Aizen at once. So how the fuck would he know? And he's never felt him release his Bankai before either. Whatever. So then the Baro, it's like, ah, seems the sky's all dark now. Oh, hell yeah. Hey there, Shinsui.
I grew fucking talons, by the way.
And Shinsui is like, sorry I kept you waiting. By the way, what's your impression of all this? What's the world look like to you? Does it appear dark and lonely? Hopeless? And the Baro's like, yeah, it does look darker. Oh, is this your Bankai? Yes, it is Bankai. Well, yeah, it's kind of darker, but no, it doesn't feel hopeless because I'm the ultimate life form and God's final experiments. I'm going to shoot you now! Boom! And it blows off like an entire, like, huge chunk of the island that they're on. He is super powerful, basically. And so he's like, oh, you know, I don't know anything about your Bankai, but if I kill you, then the Bankai will disappear, so that's all I gotta do. Oh no, I'm wounded now! What happened? And Shinsui is like, this is Act 1, Tame Raikizu no Wakachiai. Wow, God, what a mouthful. The sharing of pain! Wounds inflicted on the enemy surface on oneself as if to share them. See, look, my shoulder wound is also appearing on you too, but you cannot die from those wounds, which makes them kind of pointless, but they hurt real bad. Yes, this is my Bankai. It is called Kaken Kyokatsu Karamatsu Shinju. So be quiet, because this is a performance, because it is theatrically themed. The title of my Bankai-C is the title of the play. Withered Pine loves suicide. So there's Act 2! Zaki no Shitone, The Pillow of Shame, which is a stupid fucking title. A man who regrets wounding his enemy falls to the floor from shame and suffers an incurable sickness. And so Lilibaro gets the measles real bad, basically. And then Shinji says, at Act 3, Danyo no Fuchi, The Abyss, accepting their fate. They throw themselves into the springing water, because they're surrounded by tons of water now and they're drowning, until each other's spiritual pressures are exhausted. Basically, I just destiny bonded your ass.
You very
oh, it's so stupid!
First thing, I will say, I like Shun Sui's kind of explanation, just because this does feel very thematic for him. Like, in a way, like I feel it does kind of play to the character we've seen for him. This is a strange Bankai, but I think there are rules to it we don't quite understand. It basically seems like his Bankai is like, yeah, I kill you. Like, it just is. Like, you just die. He's like, no.
It seems like he's... It seems like... Because it's called a suicide pact. Yeah. It also says, we're both going to die, basically.
Yeah.
Which indicates, how the fuck does he know this? Because clearly he's never used the Bankai before.
Yeah, I mean, he must have, like saw it in a book, or, like, I don't know, like, his fucking spirit thing talked to him, like, hey, bro, I don't know, bum you out, but, EB Bankai, we're gonna fucking die.
Yeah.
But...
You had the better type advantage and stuff like that, but I use explosion, so,
Yeah, you're not a steel type or ghost, so, yeah, suck it.
He could be exaggerating and might be instead saying, I am basically draining both of our spiritual pressures until one of us dies. In which case, that's fucking hacks, dude.
Yeah. And it's interesting in at least the extent of, like, maybe... Because they make a big deal. He's like, I hope nobody's in the area. I hope no now's all right. So maybe it's also just anyone in the area is affected by this, and that could kill them potentially, too. Like, they'll immediately start feeling a lot of this stuff as well. So in that regard, this could help also explain why he didn't use this against Aizen or anything like that. Because this actually is him, like, sacrificing himself. Like, what a weird character for you to, like, kill yourself for. Like, oh, I'm one of the four Espot, like, the four other Quincy dudes that are left. Like, I get he's powerful, but I feel like someone else has some bullshit Bankai that could help here. This is like one of the weird chapters where I'm like, man, I really could do with some fucking character showing up and just explaining their fucking power nice and neat right here. Like, in front of fucking Junsu, he's like, oh, you want to know what my Bankai is? Like, I didn't ask. Like, well, let me tell you about it.
I strongly suspect it is more the one of us will die, and it just depends on who gets drained first. But that does seem to indicate, like, well, why the other stuff? Why do you get all sick with the measles, and why do you develop other wounds and stuff if it's not a sharing of everything and you both die? I don't know.
Well, I got the sharing of wounds. I can understand that. I don't get the sickness part.
Yeah, especially because, like, only Lilibaro gets it.
Yeah, I'm like...
Does that mean Shinsui knows no shame?
Or, the other question, does it mean Lilibaro feels shame? Because it seemed like he really didn't. It didn't seem like he was regretful for anything. Who regrets wounding his enemy falls to the floor from shame.
Maybe he now regrets it because he has wounded himself from wounding Shinsui.
I guess. It seems like a confusing element. It
seems like
he was like,
I'm torn on this because
I need three acts and I just don't have a second. Fuck, he gets sick.
And just like, he's not actually sick, it's just like, red paint everywhere. Blah, yeah. Blah,
blah. That'd be great if he's like, how about he just loses his left hand or something like that?
I sincerely hope that both of my theories on this are wrong, because it's lame if Shinsui just kills himself, and it's also lame if he just, like, I kill you. That is my Bankai. You just die. They're both bad. So I hope that there is a third explanation and a third way that this could possibly turn out. But I don't know. I feel like I've got Bleach down pretty well right now, and this definitely seems like one of those things where if Shinsui doesn't kill himself, he's going to take himself out of commission, because that's kind of what they're doing.
With everyone.
So yeah, that was Bleach. Oh no. I am not... Unlike you were on Black Clover. Like, I was like, oh, this could get better, But I don't feel good about it right now, and I don't feel very confident that the explanation is going to make me happier. So, yeah.
Yeah, we shall see. Before I jump into Fairy Tail, I just want to note something real quick. We mentioned a very long time ago that we were working, or I was going to make up, like, a celebrity impersonation list. So if we ever need a voice to, like, just note it, and we'll, like, pick one. I have the start of that going on. So at this point, if we need a voice for something, just let me know, and I'll pick a random one for us.
Awesome.
So let's jump into Fairy Tail, chapter 458, Morning Star, which is a...
You're going to need to go solo for a little bit. I'll be right back. Go ahead.
Sure. Which is a solo, or a solo. It's a fill-your-own-adventure cover page this time, because they basically ask you to tell you what the character is saying. So Natsu's in a leather outfit, and Happy's eating the fish. And I like to think that the bubble for Natsu says, like, do you think this leather outfit makes me look lame? And Happy's probably saying, like, bitch, I don't care. I'm eating fish. Happy has a jive accent in this. So let's jump into the chapter. We come back. And Geo has been cut across the chest by Urza. And like many villains who fight Urza, he's like, this is impossible. You've beaten everything. But he knows, he's like, anything that touches me should turn to sand. There's no sword that can... And he sees that her sword is made out of water. And she explains that the sea god's sword can harden sand. Which seems like a very specific power. Like, it was like, yeah, you know how sand can harden with like water can harden sand, kind of like what Luffy did?
Right, you gotta dry it out after that and stuff.
Yeah, well, hers is very specifically like, the sea god's sword can harden sand. I'm like, why don't we just say water can harden sand? But he's like, oh, this is crazy! I had to dodge this! And then Urza gets attacked with a sandstorm, so she uses the wind god's sword to blow sand away. And I'm like, wait, like, this is another one of those forms. I'm like, I don't remember you having this, like, god form, but you just have swords that can control the elements or unleash the elements. It seems unfair.
Well, it's you know, bullshit Urza stuff, so it's just, so she does change armor between the attacks. It's a little subtle because she's got the wings on her head in both forms, but her, like, robes change or whatever. So, yeah, like, if you flip between the two pages, you can tell that, like, the fringe on her outfit is different, basically. Or is it, actually?
It looks the
she's
same
got two, she's got two swords, yeah. Ah.
Yeah.
So she just has these two swords, I guess. Okay, and it's one armor.
It might even be the same sword, I can't tell, and she just changes based on whatever god she's channeling.
There's one panel where you can see she's holding
two
swords.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I do see two swords. But yeah, she has a wind sword and a water sword, which seems pretty handy to have.
I got confused because the word bubble is blocking part of her clothing at one point, so I thought it was different. Yeah, it's just like, okay, well, you've got water and wind, I guess. Where's fire and earth? I don't know.
Yeah, she's like, that's my other outfit. So Ageo says,
I got two hands. There's no point in having four swords in one.
Unless I put it in my mouth and talk with my heart. I'm like, don't you fucking dare. So
I'll put the last one between my boobs or some shit. I don't know.
Well, of course you would. So Ageo kind of covers the entire ship and then consequently the entire town with a giant sandstorm. And they cut up around to all the various guild members reacting to this, which I didn't really kind of get why they bothered to do this. I feel like they could have done this for one person.
Just to show the scale of it, to show it is actually affecting the entire
I feel like if you... It feels like we cut to a lot of different people for the same sort of response. Like,
a lot of
sand!
It is a lot of time spent on them, and it's like, I didn't really need to see fucking Bisca reacting.
Actually the only character I think I cared about seeing, because it's the one that actually pays off later.
Okay, well, we didn't need to see Juvia grabbing Lysana.
Yeah, that was like, we could have cut that out or something like that. But Urza reacts, it's like, you mean it's covering the whole town? One person can shrink an island and another can create massive sandstorms. They really are in a class of their own. I'm like, you summoned swords from gods! And Geo has this big thing, like, welcome to Sandworld! In this world, I am God! He's basically developed this new kind of gimmick. Like, he's done being a sand guy and a desert guy. His new thing is he is a god, and you should revere him as such. So he basically beats Urza. He has her by the throat, And I presume he's basically like kind of doing that crocodile thing of like, I'm going to slowly drain all the water from your body and just dehydrate you. And he's like, you know, if you revere me as a god and beg for my forgiveness, I'll kill you immediately and give you a quick death. Otherwise, I'm just going to slowly dehydrate you and kill you that way. And he says, so now call me a god. And Urza's like, no, because even if you did become a god, my guild would never be afraid of you, because we know who we can put our faith in! And she transforms into the Morningstar armor.
The god of friendship!
Yes. She becomes this giant beacon, and Jill's like, that's not going to save you. But then the Biska sees the light, realizes it's a signal, fires at the ship, destroys it, and in that moment, Ajeel is stunned.
She specifically shoots Ajeel, I think.
Yeah, she blasts him, but it destroys the ship, and I think that's also what kind of distracts him enough for Urza to escape, transform again, and cut him across the chest, seemingly defeating him because all the sandstorm disappears. And that's a chapter.
So, yeah.
As I'll say, I really actually do sincerely like the part they did with her activating a Morningstar outfit and using that as a signal to have Biska fire. That is a cool way to combine different members of the guild into doing something. And even though I shit on her throughout this entire thing, it did make Biska look cool. It was like a cool way to combine members and have them working together. And it was an innovative way to end that fight as well. So Urza actually did something tangible to end a fight as opposed to just, I'm stronger than you. You know, this wasn't like, I just overcome you shutting off my senses. I used a clever trick to win this fight. And I thought that worked, yeah.
That said, they better not lose too many more of this friggin' 12 on this whole invasion thing. Or Ajeel better not be actually defeated or something.
And also, I'm really, like, every time, like, I feel like Fairy Tail is a villain, they always have to go crazy and, like, demand Urza do things. It's always like, I've defeated you, Urza, now get naked and dance for me. Like, just kill her. Just stop doing this. She always beats you when you do this. Oh. But otherwise, I like the chapter for what we got at the end there. I actually kind of dug that.
I like the conclusion of the fight as well, but like I was alluding to, you know, because we've been talking about it for a long time. It's like, well, building up this supervillain group, hope they don't lose to Fairy Tail immediately.
Yeah, hope Urza doesn't immediately kill one of them.
And there you go. I mean, it's not confirmed quite yet if Ajeel is defeated forever or not, but it seems like he is, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I will note, as Cheddar's saying in chat, it is a cheesy little joke, or not cheesy joke, but a cheesy line of like, we know who I'll put our friends in. But again, in this moment, it does make sense because friendship actually did play a part in winning this. It wasn't just an intangible element. It was like, no, I'm friends with this person. She realizes what I'm doing is a signal and fires. So I can definitely enjoy that part of it. So let's move on to Food Wars, I think.
Food Wars! Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 140.
Might be the last time you ever get to say that title, Nick.
Oh, right. Making an example. So Aizon showed up at the Polaris Dorm, and he's like, oh, the land and all structures on it being confiscated. And everyone's like, no, fuck you!
You can't do your weekly manga recap lives voice, you're spoiling it for everybody!
Oh, no!
Oh, no!
This is
Aizon.
So everyone's like, oh, how dare you, except Soma comes in and he's like, Aizon Senpai, you know, standing here chatting is nice and all, but how about you come in and have some tea? And Aizon holds his smirk for one panel and then he's like, wait, what? it's a wonderful like three panels right there. Oh boy. So yeah, they sure actually do have tea. He's like serving all the people who have showed up with Aizon and stuff. He's like, oh, be careful, the tea is hot and stuff. And Aizon's like, be serious! I'm gonna close your dorm! Fuck you guys! So someone's, you know, trying to reason with him at first. And he says, you know, why do you have to get rid of this place? You know, we've been like self-governing for a long time and stuff. Why do you have to butt in with us and so on and so forth? And Aizon explains, a body only needs one head. In today's institute, that is central. So, here's your eviction notice. Read this. You've got a couple of weeks in order to pack up and move out. And, you know, if you don't make trouble, you'll get to stay here and stuff. So, Soma's like, well, do you think it's still possible to overturn the decision to close the dorm with a Shokugeki? And Aizen clearly has been expecting this. He just, you know, smirks and says, yeah, if you win a Shokugeki, you can overturn any decision you want. But that's only if both sides are willing to accept the challenge. And, you know, there's nothing that says we are obliged to accept this. And almost every club and society is clamoring to have their dissolution order reversed. So, you know, the orders are piling up and stuff like that for the challenge and so on. But, you know, I could ignore them, but instead I have actually decided to accept the challenge. In fact, I'm accepting, like, all the challenges, basically. So, you know, I'll fit you into my schedule somewhere, yeah. And everyone's like, all right, yeah, we've got a chance in order to do this. And someone's like, wow, I'm actually surprised that you're, you know, being generous enough to accept the challenge. And he says, yeah, you know, I'll have the other side accept equal risk, of course. Ah, this may be a good time to make an example out of someone for you. So, yeah, you know, let's see if we can fit something into the schedule. But, yeah. Well, gotta go answer a challenge. And it's being televised and stuff. And he's going up against the skewer guy that Soma faced off after the stagiaire week. This guy's shown up a few times in little flashes here and there. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I guess, keeping him relevant in your mind as, like, just an example of a club head.
And I love that he fucking, like, when they have, like, their beginning cooking shot, he's holding his skewers like Wolverine claws.
I love that. He looks so badass, doesn't he? So, yeah, you know, the guy's like, oh, you know, if I win, you know, the society will not be disbanded. And Aizen's like, yep, okay. And you're going to be expelled if on the spot if you lose. You accept those terms, right? Yep. I have honed my skills like the point of a skewer.
He's like, yeah. All right, let's get started. Yeah. Let's skewer.
You want to give it everything you've got. So they have their big showdown. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, we've got a chance. You know, if we can beat Aizen, we can preserve everything. We're not going to give up. We still have the Shokugeki. And everyone's like, yeah, we got a chance. But Soma immediately is like, because they're watching it on TV, and they're televising the Shokugeki, and Soma just says, something's not right. And he points out Aizen does not look like he's putting any effort into what he's actually doing. And they're like, well, what's that mean? And Soma says, hey, well, you remember what he said. He said, this will be a good time to make it out, to make an example out of someone for you. So he catches on, you know, even if he wins this, that doesn't necessarily mean that every research society is going to stop, you know, having hope. You know, that they might continue on with this. They might think, oh, you know, I can beat him and stuff. Why is he so confident that this one Shokugeki is going to be an example? And so they both present their dishes, and immediately, Aizen wins. The results come up, he wins all three judges. And so Kabutoyama, the skewer guy, says, has there been some sort of technical malfunction? You guys haven't tasted anything yet. Why is there a score? And all the judges just kind of smirk evilly. And he's like, no, you bought the judges! And Aizen sticks his tongue out, squints one of his eyes up, and goes, Seki!
What would that sound like in the Aizen voice?
Sucker! You lose! So, yeah, one of the guys there is just like, well, you lose. And Kabutoyama was like, hey, you bribed the judges, didn't you? This Shokugeki isn't valid. No one's going to accept this. And Aizen says, oh, the Totsuki of today isn't what it used to be, you know. You're expelled. Goodbye. I'm getting a little bit Pegasus into that, aren't I? Huh.
Yugi boy.
Kabutoyama boy. Soma boy. This is his voice now. Just started off as snooty asshole, now he's Pegasus. I'll take it. But yeah, so everyone's like, well, Shokugeki's what we thought we could use to fight this, but if he just buys the judges, we don't have a chance. We don't even have a fair fight. And because they are controlled by Central, no one can say, like, oh, this is an unfair Shokugeki now. So, yeah, and Aizen kind of turns up to the camera, this cocky look on his face, spreading his arms out, and he says to himself, how'd you like my example? Shokugeki are dead.
Bun, dun, dun.
So yeah, this was another, you know, huge development chapter in food, where it's just continuing the recurring trend of shit is getting bad at Tatsuki. But I mean, I'm very surprised by this development, but I mean, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. You know, they gotta get rid of the one method that they have of actually challenging their authority, which now begs the question, what the fuck are they gonna do?
I was mentioning on the WMR Twitter, WMR podcast, and I said, I was like, if this like change like stands still, this really does change the status quo of the series quite a lot. I know eventually at some point Shokugekis are gonna become a thing again, but it's like,
well,
how do they get around this?
I assume that Shokugekis are still a thing, or they could still be a thing, but if it comes to the point of, you know, throwing off, you know, the status quo as Izami wants it, then they're not going to be valid. You know, Aizen will use his resources, buy off of the judges, no matter what happens, and then that's it. You know, so nothing of consequence will be accomplished with the Shokugeki. Maybe individual disputes will happen, but only insofar as if they don't interfere with Izami's plans. So that basically does mean Shokugekis are pretty much done for the series until this, you know, is changed back again somehow.
Yeah. But it's
which very... I imagine it will be eventually. The series is called Shokugeki no Soma.
Yeah. So yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I'm curious to see what Aizen can actually do, because we've never actually seen him cook before, I don't think.
No, it's just his manipulation of resources.
Yeah, he's great at running a business and never like a restaurant every possible way, but we've never actually seen him cook. So seeing that he did this and he didn't give a fuck, so we didn't even see what his dish is, it's just like intriguing. Like, I wonder what this dude actually is like, because he's on the council tent. He's in the institute. He has to be a good chef. I really want to see what this dude does when he actually tries. But I feel like this is a good kind of like startup antagonist. He cooks money. So I just suggest.
Well, and also he was ranked 9 in the council of 10. Yeah. So he is literally the lowest among their enemies on the council.
Yeah. But he also just kind of exists as a good starting point for it. Because he is outright the most evil part of the Council of Ten, like
so far that we've seen.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
we have not even met some of the others who voted
yes,
in favor of his
own. That is true, but anything we know about this guy has shown he's a dickhead, like he's just an asshole. So yes, we could find out like Tsukasa eats babies, like he cooks babies as like that's his main dish thing. He's like, it used to be I let the ingredients speak for themselves. Actually, my new gimmick is babies. I cook babies.
They speak for themselves because they are human children.
I feel like we'll get, you know, something that categorizes the rest of these other characters as evils, but this is the guy who outright is just clearly, we know this guy's evil. If Izami never joined the fucking club or the school, this dude would still be evil. He's just a bad person.
Because he has been fucking with Soma since the tournament arc as well.
Yeah, so from that, I feel like he's
a they touch upon that in the chapter. I kind of glossed over it, but Soma's like, oh, why are you doing this all of a sudden? And everyone's like, I guess I didn't realize that he was the one behind Subaru trying to get him kicked out. Oh, God. It's just a fun little detail on, you know, Soma is ignorant sometimes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, very huge development, and I'm intrigued as hell, because like, what the hell are they going to do? It seems like they've got no options, which means it's going to be fascinating to see them try and find their way out of this.
Yep. Good chapter.
Alright, let's move on.
My Hero Academia!
Number 64, the task at hand. Last time, I was about to fuck up her name twice, because I got her...
Yaya Rosso.
Yeah, or Momo, but so I was gonna do like Momo Rozu, but it's
Momomozu.
So she has just set Todoroki free, and Todoroki's like, "Oh, you've got a plan, right? Yeah, you know." So I've actually been thinking about it from the start. That's great. Just tell me what it is. Yeah. So Aizawa thinks to himself, like, "Okay, I can't keep my quirk going for long stretches, so I need time to recover and stuff if I want to actually keep them disabled." So if she noticed that and wants to exploit that, more power to her. And he tries to attack them with his weird bandage whip thing. And so Todoroki tries to use his firepower, but of course it just gets erased and stuff. So Yairuzu says, "Okay, look, if we have a little bit of time to prepare for this, you know, we'll be able to win, so just run for right now and hide." And they manage to get out of his line of sight, And she says, okay, yeah, just keep on, follow what I say, try to use your ice and stuff.
But she also notes that his eyesight isn't as good because of the injury he took back at the villain break-in before.
And the flashbangs as well.
Yeah. So she's like, you have to take advantage of that because there's going to be a moment when he's going to lose vision of us, and that's when you're going to be able to use your power.
She says, when he blinks, that's your chance.
And she knows that he can do something that because she saw him create that giant wall of ice in an instant for the tournament. It kind of just goes to show how observant of a character this Yayorozu is.
Right. So Todoroki ends up summoning his giant wall of ice. So Aizawa, of course, is very distracted by this. He's like, okay, yeah, you know, good job using the enemy's weakness against them and stuff. And they use that time, and so Todoroki's like, okay, you know, can you explain your plan while we've got time now? And turns around, Yayorozu's opened her vest up and is summoning this giant thing out of nowhere. And it's like, I like the little detail where Todoroki doesn't get flustered or anything like that, but he immediately turns back around.
I like when he turns and stares, like, there's no reaction to him.
He's like, she has opened her vest. I will turn back around now.
I was listening to a podcast, and they, like, brought this up. They're like, why didn't she just, like, do it out of her arms or something like that? And they're like, because it wouldn't be funny. I'm like, I feel like that answer, she just does it because it's a funny thing.
Well, and also, she specifically opens her vest up so that she'll expose as much surface area as possible to summon the thing as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Time's of the essence.
But, yeah.
I feel like that. It's like, yeah, the bustiest character in the series is suddenly, and so he's like, okay then.
Yeah, just no reaction to it. I feel like he's just like, he's the straight man in the school who just, like, hates the silliness. He's like, I fucking hate that stupid fucking gum hair guy.
He's very polite, though.
Yeah. He does. He doesn't comment on it. He just turns. Doesn't get, like, blush or anything.
Yeah, I like how the only comment he has is like, are you making Aizawa's weapon? And she says, yeah, I don't know exactly what it's made from, but I've woven something else into it. It's my own version of it. So she kind of summarizes what their goals are. Okay, we need to keep damage to a minimum stuff, but he's got a binding weapon, so it's hard to actually pin him down. But this way, if we do this, I think we'll actually have a better chance if we run away. If we actually capture him. So she gets Todoroki to agree with that. And so Aizawa's like, okay, let's see here. Where are they going to do next? What's their plan? And then he sees these cloaked figures coming around the corner, and he's like, ah, very good. I can't erase what I can't see. But if you are doing that, then you're at a great disadvantage. And he just quickly ties them both up together with his bandage. But the cloak comes off, and it turns out that just Yayorozu was under there, and she had, like, a mannequin head posing as Todoroki. And also, she has a fucking catapult. which, I'm not sure exactly what happens. It seems like she misses the trigger.
She just misses. It's weird, because it's meant to be this thing, like, look, she's very smart, she's very observant. In the moment, though, she panics and kind of, like, messes up. But ultimately, it works out for them, is what we see. But it's so weird that, like, her moment of missing it was, like, I fucked up a high five, essentially. Like, I just whiffed completely on pressing a button.
Well, she just presses it again properly the second time, but it did look like it was going to be a whole, her plan just backfired because she fucking is clumsy as shit.
Like, there's I've been playing the game Life is Strange recently, and, like, your whole thing in that is you have, like, time rewinding power. And you do it for, like, these crazy awesome things at points. But some of the time you need to use your power. It's like the game designer's like, oh, you haven't used it well, which reminds you. It's like you have to reach for a phone, but you're so fucking, like, retardedly clumsy, you just knock a bottle of water over on it and destroy it first. You're like, uh-oh, I have to rewind time to do it. It's like one of those fucking infomercials where it's like, have you ever had trouble pouring a soda? Like, whoa!
And you just shrug at the camera.
I'm like, has anyone ever had this thing? Like, isn't it hard hitting a switch? Like, whoa!
Anyway, she hits the switch properly. She's got her special version of Aizawa's weapon. It's in this big old bundle, and when it's launched, of course, because it's like a bandage, it spreads out, and so it starts to kind of ensnare him. And then, you know, she calls out to Todoroki. He blasts it with his fire, and it just kind of goes underneath Aizawa, and he's like, what are they thinking? They completely missed me. And Yayoi Rose says, you know, I knew our quirks would be unreliable, but have you ever heard of nitinol alloy? When heated, it temporarily returns to its original form. It's an alloy with shape memory. And the metal bandage just immediately shrinks up and returns to its original shape and binds him up immediately. And so I was like, oh, not bad. And they slapped the handcuffs on him, and yeah, they did it. So Yayoi Rose observes, I messed up trying to hit the catapult. And you realize that, and you actually backed off. You could have defended yourself, but you took the hit, so my strategy would work. But Aizawa says, well, I had to be on guard against Todoroki. I could see you, but not him under the cloth. I was sure he would try to freeze me. So backing off was actually my optimal strategy. And isn't that how your plan was meant to go? So Todoroki's like, yeah, you know, you just need a little bit of time. So good job. And she gets all choked up over it. And Todoroki completely misinterprets this. And he's like, yeah, if you need to vomit, you know, you could just, you know, put pressure on your instep. Like, no, it's nothing. I'm liking Todoroki more and more as he gets to interact with more people. Like, because he had that really stressful encounter with Deku. He had the big showdown with Bakugo, and then he bounced off of Ida, and there's been a level of kind of confrontation with a lot of people, but now that he's had to work with someone else, he seems a lot more human and fun.
Yeah, he went from being, like, kind of this Prince Zuko-esque character, kind of was just like driven by anger and revenge, and you know, these
and the scar over his left eye,
yeah, and fire powers. But he's now become someone who you're like, oh, he actually has like a personality with other people that's amusing. You know, he has like these interactions with people, and I just like the idea that like the cast is slowly becoming like a superhero team. Mm-hmm. Like they just are starting to have relationships with one another. And I love what this chapter just did for Yayoi Rose, because it's essentially they went into this like, yeah, this was going to be a fight that it seemed like Todoroki was going to be the important character on, but as we saw, that was part of the point, was to show that he can be extra powerful, but he needs to listen to other people because they might actually have better plans. And they did. Like, Yayoi Rose showed that she's a very smart, observant person who ultimately, she's really the entire crux of what causes them to win. Like, she's the one who comes up with the plan, she's the one who creates the material for it. All Todoroki does is make the shield that delays them, and then puts the fire that heats up the weapon. But really cool kind of showing from her that I just like that we got to see for her character.
So Todoroki and Yairozu's victory is announced across all the other testing facilities as well, and so Mineta starts to panic. Is like, ah, come on, they're announcing these. Wake up, Sero! Come on, get up! Because they look to be in bad straits. Also in bad straits are Earjack Girl and Coda, the guy who can speak to animals, because Mike...
Present Mike.
Present Mike, right. His voice is so loud that he's scaring all the animals away, so they're just kind of, like, standing there covering their ears, basically. As
well, she has super crazy good hearing, too, so it's gotta be like just god awful for her.
So he's just like stalking them through the forest and stuff. And
I like her design. I guess I never realized what she looked like in her hero outfit, but she just basically looks like a punk rocker. So
which goes along with her power theme too.
Yeah, it's cool, cool aesthetic.
And they say like, oh, you know, he's on top of the mountain, but we can't even get close to him. He just keeps on yelling and driving us away because ow, it hurts, basically. And then we get to All Might, and he's like, oh, good job, boys, you reluctantly cooperated to fight against the enemy, but that was merely a prerequisite for the exam. And he's just like standing on their corpses, basically.
He's beating them.
I mean, they're not done yet, but yeah. He's like, you know, stepping down on Bakugo. He's got Deku up suspended by one arm. It's just giant toothpaste spread of I am super powerful, basically. So
at this point, I truly and completely want to see, maybe not all of them, although I would not be opposed to it, but I really want to see more of these other fights going on. At least the other ones that have significant characters. Like, I want to see what Uraraka and, like, Ida are doing. Like, I want to see those fights play out. Also the one with the Sway and Tokoyami? Is that the bird guy?
Yes. Tokoyami and Asui.
Yeah. Like, those fights, I definitely would love to see what they're doing, because I really love what we've gotten out of just this one instance. Like, I'm really curious to see how these other ones are going. It's really cool kind of character development that's really invested me in this. I without any exaggeration, thought this was the clear-cut best manga of the week.
I would agree. Yeah.
It really had, like, a big moment to it. It developed things. Just strong all the way through. I'm already putting it down for, you know, like, the next time we do a WMR Lives or something like that. I feel like this would be a good chapter for it. It was just a really fun, entertaining part of the, like, it was just really good. And I'm really enjoying what this arc is doing with My Hero Academia right now. It's really kind of reinvigorating me into it. I mean, it's weird. I shouldn't need to be reinvigorated since this has been a pretty strong year for the series in general, but something about this part in, you know, in particular is just really getting me invested into it.
Hmm. Yeah, dug it.
Yep. And I'm glad we're going to get more of Bakugo and Deku.
I do want to see some of the other 8 fights that are going on, even if it's just brief little scenes like the ones that we saw in this chapter. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to One Piece. Chapter 804, Adventure in the Land Atop the Elephant's Back.
With a sad cover page of Ace pitching to Luffy and Sabo, but he can't because he's dead!
So, we start off with the Straw Hats and company climbing up the side of the elephant on the dragon that Kanjuro has drawn for them, when suddenly something comes falling down from the sky, and it's shrieking. It's a monkey with a hat, and it goes A-da-da-da-da-da-da. So Luffy briefly impersonates this, and Kanjuro says, "Yes, that is the sound Raizo makes as he runs." And then everyone ducks out of the way as the monkey nearly crashes into them. They, like, pull a bobsled, basically, all sway in one direction to, you know, dodge it. And Kanjuro says, "Blindfold time!" and covers Kinemon's eyes.
It's so weird. I mean, it's, like, amusing in its own way. Like, everyone dodges, and his reaction is to them. They're like, "Let's do a blindfold game." And,
well, the joke is, he doesn't know the monkey's falling. Hence why he's like, "Yeah, that's the sound that, you know, our friend Raizo makes when he runs, because he's a ninja." That's why he reacts this way, is because he doesn't know the monkey's falling. But even so, what the fuck did he do this out of nowhere?
Well, like, I noticed, like, I guess, fuck, what's the samurai's name? I'm blanking on it. Kinemon, that's right. Kinemon's like, "Oh, you prankster, you." Like, I guess that's just part of his personality. We've seen very little of Kanjuro, so it's not, you know, I guess maybe it is a part of his personality, just don't remember it. But it's just like, "Eh, we need a way to get rid of these two for a little bit." Fucking monkey falls on them, it's their friend.
So yeah, they fall down through the sky, and they're like, "Oh no, they fell!" You know, and it's like, "Oh yeah, you know, what was it that just fell towards us?" And Ronan says, "I don't know. At first I thought it was a blood-drenched person stuck full of knives, but then it looked like a big monkey."
I got a new example to go to of Robin's random morbid thoughts now.
So they're like, "Oh, are you guys okay?" And they Kinemon calls up, "I'm fine. Go ahead. We'll catch up." He's like, "Okay, whatever."
Yeah.
But Zoro's like, "We should go get them. Hey, dragon, you should climb down." But it's like, "Arr, arr,
arr." I feel like it has to make a cuter sound.
And they're like, "No, we can't tell the poor thing to go back. Oh, it just wants to finish its duty quickly. Okay, we'll meet up later, guys. Bye." And they're like rooting for it. "Come on, dragon, you can climb up." And it goes on for like 3 pages.
Yeah, they're all like immediately getting behind him because they see the struggle.
It's like it's the little dragon that could, basically.
They named him. He's Ryonosuke the dragon. They're all like, "You can do it, Ryonosuke. You can do it, Ryonosuke."
And they get up and they're like, "Yeah, we made it, Ryonosuke."
He's so happy. He's smiling.
He goes, they're like, "You're gonna turn back into a drawing now." "No, don't go, Ryunosuke!" And it fades back into a drawing, and they're like, "Ryunosuke!"
Like,
and
they're like,
his image, like, appears on the sunset. And they're like, "Ryunosuke!" Ah!
And then they cut to Zoro and Law, who are just like, "It's just a crappy drawing, can we go?" And I mean, like, there's 2 types of people in this world. There's the people who mourn Ryunosuke and the people who don't, and I don't want to be friends with the latter.
I'm totally with Zoro-in-law.
Oh, God, no, Nick!
It's like, it's a fucking drawing.
I had feelings. feels for the dragon.
And Usopp's like, oh, you think about what you're saying.
Robin made a fucking grave for him.
Oh, it's fucking hilarious.
Oh, God, I love One Piece.
Well, yeah, they're like, okay, well, look, it's, there's a gateway, but there's no guards here. Hey, Usopp, you should, you know, come up here and check this place out. We get a big shot of the landscape. There's a fucking whale tree. It's really weird looking.
Yeah, I was like, this doesn't fit thematically with an elephant planet.
And Usopp's like, oh, there's something strange about that place. But then Luffy jumps down into the forest and like, oh, God damn it, Luffy. And they're observing, like, huh, the gate's wide open. They have the gates were snapped off the hinges and stuff. They're trying to take the... guys of what's going on. They're seeing these huge ass footprints and stuff, but it's like, huh, it's weird to walk on the surface because it's an elephant and so on and so forth. And then weird people suddenly come in. These, it's time for furries in One Piece, we get this one small girl attacks them. She's got like bunny ears, and but then, I mean, Zoro like kind of knocks her away. She like dodges his sword. She seems to have electric powers.
Well, it's interesting because what she does, she like jumps into the air, he swings, and then she like kind of floats up above the attack.
Right.
So I'm almost wondering if that's like a Dofer, or if we might be getting introduced to like some new mechanic of the One Piece world, kind of like right. the six forms.
Right. Is this Devil Fruit powers, or is this like a, you know, is this a
dial or something like that? Like, is this new, some new element of the world?
Right. And also, she's got electric powers too.
Yeah.
She shocks him through his sword, but then. She is called off. Her name is Carrot. She is called off by this woman who is riding on the back of what looks to be a giant warthog of sorts. And she's wearing Nami's clothes. And they're like, huh? And that's the end of the chapter. It's like, well, that's weird. Okay.
Law calls them specifically minks. So I guess right. This is a race of people. They are basically furries of the One Piece universe. Which, as an admin of a One Piece role playing forum, I feel like this has opened up a door.
Yeah, I'm like, fuck,
there's furries everywhere now.
So, yeah, I guess we're going to find out more about this later on. I mean, it is very much you know, time to start establishing the world for the new arc that they've got coming up. But there was that really hilarious thing with Ryunosuke. So.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I get that, then I'm fine. It's not like I just like this chapter or anything like that. Not a lot happened with it, but it was funny, which that's all I really need right there.
Okay, Toriko. Gourmet 344 to the back channel. They went to the back channel.
The end. It's God. I don't get Toriko. I cannot grasp it. Why, after like 2 weeks of being like, okay, we're kind of getting back on track, it goes back to that thing where it's like, hey, you know how last week ended? Let's just completely go somewhere different. This chapter, for some reason, goes backwards to show us what happened. After Komatsu explained to us what happened.
We don't need to see this.
The
only thing that we really needed to see was Don Slam coming to the decision of what they should do. You know, him saying like, yeah, you know, we're going to bring back the one person that I ever respected, Ichiryu. And to do that, we need to get the full course menu. And then they went to the back channel in order to do that. But then it's like, and now we have to see Komatsu going to this place and learn more about the souls and stuff. Because remember, that was a thing. People get abducted by souls, and Chaka was taken off and stuff. And also, there is the squid girl here, and she is looking after these weird, gross ingredients, which she doesn't like because they come from Earth or whatever. And there's like all this lineup of people who are going to get replaced with the food spirits or whatever like that. But Chaco's mother shows up at the last second to save him, it seems like. And Don Slime shows up and is like, fuck you, food spirits, and they start disintegrating because they're scared by him. And they come to this gateway, which is filled with souls, food grudges, and naked acacia, and mysterious woman that Komatsu encounters.
Yeah, it's like, okay, but why would you have shown us this if you already showed us them coming out of the time skip? Like,
it seems like this is something that should have happened like 5 weeks ago.
Like, this is like, we should have naturally seen these chapters then you get to the chapter where you show them, like, all leaving this, and you're like, oh, okay, and, like, we've seen them grow up. Like, it just seems weird to show and explain what happened, and, like, well, now we'll actually show you what happened. I'm like, this just seems like double the work. Like, why did you bother? Yeah. It's just strange.
Toriko continues to be stupid, basically.
And I mean, essentially, it's just like, why don't we just, you know, alright, Don Slime wants to bring back Ichiro so he can kill Acacia, and the Nitros want to just kill Acacia. Like, why can't we just get to that? I don't know. I just feel like everything's more complicated than it needs to be right
now. It really does seem that way. So, let's finish things off with World Trigger. Chapter 120, Aptoker Tour, Part 6.
Are you excited about the next country name you have to learn to pronounce, Nick?
Oh, God. So, Enadora has just told Osamu and Yuma and Mr. Kinuda that Husei's master is going to be Aptoker Tour's next god. And so Osama's like, what do you mean by his master? And Enadora says, he's kind of like a foster parent, because the way that stuff works with the higher up families and stuff, see, you know, even if you are, you know, a peasant, you could be raised with super awesome Trion. So a lot of the peasant children with high Trion get, you know, adopted essentially by these higher families and are raised to be their soldiers and stuff. But the Erens, the family that Husei was adopted into, they are known to be soft hard, so they probably raised Husei like a family member more than as a soldier. And so they're like, well, how did Husei not know that his master might be sacrificed? Well, Hirene probably didn't talk about it with him, and so he was like, how do you know all this? Because basically, he did the same thing to both of us. He told Enadora that he would abandon, that they might abandon Husei. He told Husei they might abandon Enadora. And basically made it seem like each of them was in on the secret, and they were helping to betray the other, when in fact they were both being played. Which is pretty smart. So, Enadora concludes, you know, Husei probably is thinking about what's going on now. He is probably thinking of using a chance to, you know, get back and to Aptoker Tour and stuff. If he finds out that Gallipola or Rhodochrone...
Are you very happy Rhodochrone is not the one attacking?
Yes. If he finds out they're getting closer, he will make a move. It's his chance to return to Aptoker Tour. And of course,
he's on the map. What is Rhodochrone? Like, what is that language? Like, is he making the word up, or is it based off of some language that exists?
Maybe that's what they call themselves.
No, but I mean, like, how did Ashihara come up with the name Rhodochrone? He had to have had something before it, or was he just like, I just made up words?
I don't know.
I like to think that, like, there's some language influence to it. I'm just curious what the language is that has a word like Rhodochrone in it.
I don't know.
It's based on Greek, apparently.
There we go. So they finished getting their information, basically, and Enadora says, all right, go home. I'm busy here. Which I love.
I'm like, what are you doing? You go home and watch movies.
That's why he's telling them to go home, is because he was promised he would get to watch another movie.
He's like, I get to watch the rest of fucking the Arnold Schwarzenegger's movie catalog. Like, I don't know how to break this to you. It only goes down from there. That was his high point.
Well, T2 is an amazing movie.
So. It is, but hold on. I'm going to look up his
high... Well, he's got Conan the Barbarian, Batman and Robin. Batman and Robin is what they watch next.
I want to see... I'm going to look up Arnold Schwarzenegger's filmography, and I want to go to Terminator 2 and just see what basically he's going to be in for following this. He's going to be watching Dave. I assume it's in chronological order from there.
Okay.
So it's Dave, Last Action Hero, True Lies.
That's a fun movie.
Junior.
That's not a good movie.
Eraser, which I don't even know what that is.
I don't even know what that is, no.
Jingle All the Way.
Oh, that is an amazing movie.
Batman and Robin.
That's an awfully amazing movie.
At End of Days. So he's got some rough times ahead of him.
Those are some bad movies. Anyhow, so Yuma and Osama are, of course, you know, talking about the situation, and Yuma brings up, hey, you know, is Husei going to be our fourth team member? And someone says, I don't know. And Yuma says, well, you know, it is tricky, because he is a neighbor. And Osama says, well, you're a neighbor, Kuga.
And who told you? He cuts his throat off.
Yumiko has a weird kind of facial expression in response to that. He's like, oh yeah, I forgot.
Emma? Oh, right. All right.
But Osama's like, yeah, you know, it would be a problem if he's part of the attack. But he says, well, you know, it's a standard tactic to get, you know, skilled enemies to defect. And, you know, if he wants to go home, he could be very valuable to us because we want to go to Aftepertor and stuff. But, you know, of course, you know, it is kind of difficult to gauge the situation because he would have his own agenda and all that stuff. And also, as Konami pointed out, convincing HQ will be difficult. So Yuma says...
Was that your Konami voice?
No, that was Yuma's
voice. Like, hello there, everybody. It's me, Konami.
Hmm.
You say that bacon gives you cancer. Oh, no.
That was a stupid point, Osamu. I'm putting you in a headlock now. So Yuma says, should we do our own research into these territories and stuff? But Osamu says, now let's just leave that to Jin. And if they assign a mission to us, we'll do our jobs. Let's focus on winning our upcoming battle. So they head off in their own directions because Yuma's got to do solo rank wars. We go back to the training room where Chica is testing out the weighted bullets, the lead bullets. She now has
Nibus.
Is it an Nibus?
Yeah, she has an Nibus.
Anyway, she shoots it, and it's this really slow-moving glob. And Natsumi even is able to, like, say, oh man, it's moving so slowly. She, like, sticks her finger out to poke it, and it fucking explodes into lead bullets all over. Just, like, a fucking car-sized thing appears around her. So, Izuru's like, yeah, you know, this would be really effective if you land a hit. Huh.
But they know, like, that's just not gonna...
It's impractical. It would be super effective if you could hit with it. I think that maybe she'll, like, use it at point-blank range at some point in the series.
Yeah, at some point it's going to be a factor, but yeah.
Yeah, but she's going to use the lightning and stuff. You know, they're like, oh, the asteroids seem kind of useful too, and stuff, and so on. So, I like how they're just kind of debating this while Chica's just kind of observing. And she's like, I'm the quiet character. You guys can talk about what I'm going to do.
Well, no, it's cool because she's enjoying the moment because she follows it up by being like, it's just really nice that we're all around the same age and we're able to talk together.
Yeah, she's happy.
Yeah, it's like kind of cute that she's just watching. She's just quietly sitting around and watching because she's just enjoying the moment.
No, we're working things out. It's fun. And Natsumi's like, what is that supposed to mean? And Yuzuru is like, I'm having fun too.
I'm like, oh god, you're too obvious, dude. You need to fucking... I don't know, like...
You need to hold her hand already. Come on.
I'm like, look, this is really not going to work out if we have two Hinatas. A Hinata cannot fall in love with another Hinata.
But Natsumi's like, well, you know, your teammates help you out. Although she calls them Four Eyes and the Little Guy. Which is kind of cool.
Which is a morning news team, I believe, in Boston.
For us and the little guy.
Yeah.
And Chica says, I don't want to get in their way, though. That is a very Hinata thing to say. And then, So Yuzuru's like, you know, I'm always free to help out. I think the order they talk in is Chica says, Natsumi says, I don't mind, I'm always free. And Yuzuru says, I have some time to spare, too. And Natsumi says, ooh, Yuzuru, ooh la la. It's not like that.
Yeah, because Yuzuru has the square kind of dialogue box for whatever reason. I guess because he's
for some reason
emotionless. Yeah.
Then we cut to the response team meeting again as they are dispersing and such.
No comment on their operator being like, "Ah, it's good to be young."
No.
Aw, that was cute.
It's just a throwaway line, I think.
And the cat is watching, so he saw the strategy with the big, giant weight, and in his mind...
I would have to warn Aftokator about the leaded bullets with the lightning gun.
He's like, I've seen their strategies. They have too much power.
Now.
He's like, after this Betty Rob, I will report this to my leaders.
Oh right there, yes.
Which is me. I'm the leader.
No, don't put me there!
Now it's too much!
Feed me. Feed me right now.
What's that box? Give me that box. I don't want this box. Push it off the table. Give me another box.
Ah, yes. This is a nice bed. I don't like it anymore. I'm going to sit in the box it came in now.
Now
feed me. Fill my bowl. I can see the bottom of the bowl. You have to feed me more.
Yes, it means the food's gone.
There's no more food. This is completely empty.
What weird stealth technology did you do to make my food suddenly disappear?
I know they took two mouthfuls, but it's empty now. What have you done?
Meaden has such fantastic technology, I must discover its purpose.
Now.
Also, you'll die.
I feel like we fit in all of our cat owner jokes right there. So, there's a little bit of, you know, just casual dialogue among the people who were in the response team meeting. Just like, oh, hey, you know, Miwa, you're looking better. Did you get a haircut? And Miwa's like, shut up.
Although it is interesting, he kind of really blows off Tachikawa and Jin, but he stops and actually chats and is rather respectful to Izami.
Azuma,
which I'm really curious to find out what his deal is. It's a dude who's been, like, one of the longest members of Border, but is still a B-rank agent. Like, I'm wondering what his whole story is.
And, well, Azuma,
and everyone respects him. Like, everyone treats him with a lot of respect. The first
member. He has been known to have connections to some of the more problematic members of Border as well.
Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious to find out what this dude's whole deal is. I feel like this is almost as much of like a little bit of like a glimpse back into Miwa as it was also a way to kind of tease Azuma.
So Arashiyama speaks with Jin and Tachikawa, and he's like, "Ah, looks like Miwa's kind of opening up a little." You're such an optimist, and Tachikawa says, "He totally ignored me." He looks so happy with this too. Like his eyes glinting as they, I was ignored.
It's weird to think that at one point in time, Tachikawa was like this, like kind of jerk. like this jerk, insidious looking dude. Because every time we've seen him since then, he's just like, he just has a sparkle on his face and he's just eating. And he seems like he couldn't find a problem with the world. He's just so content with everything.
So Arashiyama says, "Hey, you know, Jin, don't put too much stress on yourself. It's not just your responsibility if something happens." And Jin says, "I know, but you know, also."
Wait, no, Nick, you need to do a wacky voice for Jin. Okay. All right, he's Bill Clinton.
Oh, fuck. I know. I'll rely on my strong friends. After all, we don't even know what the enemy is like.
Nailed it.
Monica. But anyway, that's like a big, you know, ominous line as we then cut to, I forget if they actually say who this is or not.
It's the other country, because they mention there's two, and they note the other one in there.
It's Galadadadala. I forgot what it actually was, so.
Guadalupe. I was like, hey, it's a real country. It sounds kind of like it, right?
It's not a real country.
Galapola. That's it. Galapola.
So, we cut to Galapola, as they're apparently the country that's approaching immediate border contact in under 800. So, they're like, yeah, they don't have enough men to spare. Speaking of Rodokun. God damn it.
Rada, whatever.
Right. So they're like, yeah, they say they might send Tryon soldiers instead. Ah, what weak fodder, blah, blah, blah. They're also sending Idris. But we've got new triggers, it's fine. And we see a whole bunch of them, and it's really weird because, you know, we've seen, of course, Tokutora's group, and of course these guys are, you know, subservient to them, but they look so different. They look like completely regular humans. And they're dressed really normally, too, except for one guy who's wearing this weird helmet. They're just, like, all sitting around in the barracks, basically, with very normal-looking hairstyles and normal-looking faces and normal-looking clothes. And they're like, yeah, time to go over the mission details now. And the one most unusual-looking guy in the group is, like, seemingly their leader. He's just got, you know, a scar on his head because he's battle-hardened.
Interesting-looking group, at least. Like, one of the things I always kind of point out is one of the flaws of World Trigger is its art's not particularly striking, and I oftentimes see characters, I'm like, I mix these guys up a lot. But I feel like, of this group, most of them seem distinct. The female character definitely does. It's not about her eyes, I'm like, I could pick that out. The black-haired guy in the back, I feel like he's going to be a troublemaker, that you look like a lot of things. And the white hair guy kind of just looks like a white haired Kikuchi Kara, but other than that, I feel like this group should be distinct enough, and I'm just interested to see what they do. You know, they note like they have new triggers, that as Jin see that has seen it thus far, nobody should have their future being altered, so he doesn't really know what the dynamics of the attack are going to be. Like, it's very intriguing. And of course, I'm super excited, and then World Trigger goes on break for a week.
Yeah.
It hurts. It hurts so much.
Scar Guy looks like a Shin from Bleach.
Shin from Bleach.
Ichigo's dad.
Yeah, I guess if you take off the scar, yeah, he does. He also kind of reminds me a little bit of Azuma from Naruto. A little bit.
A little bit.
I might be misremembering him, yeah.
Asuma's hair is longer and his beard is more grown out.
Yeah.
But, I think that design with the kind of the beard, the sort of 5 o'clock shadow on an older character is a fairly common character design in manga. But yeah, that's it. There was also Nisekoi had a pretty big chapter, big old fight scene in it. Yu-Gi-Oh! Arc 5 had another chapter, but we're running long as it is, so I think we'll just skip past that.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. Pendulum summoning happened. Do-do-do. That's your Yu-Gi-Oh! Summary. So let's wrap things up. That's going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. Thank you for joining us here on twitch.tv/RoloT, where we record the show normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change it up. So be sure to follow us on Twitter to stay up to date on all the latest changes of our recording schedule. He is at RoloT and I'm at YRuler of Time. You can also follow at WMR Podcast for specifically manga related stuff. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And on iTunes, be sure to leave a comment or rating so we can beat the woodworking podcast.
People must tune out at this point, Nick. No one must listen because we've had like 3 weeks now with nobody doing it.
Nobody cares.
Huh? I just assume. At this point, I'm like, why not? I'm just going to walk into traffic. I feel like there's nothing left.
Now, if you can't figure out how to work iTunes and use their comment rate system and stuff like that, then I forgive you. Because even if you're just like, this is a little difficult to figure out, so fuck it. I totally understand you. I hate having to fucking use iTunes myself.
I just need to guilt trip people. We have to beat the woodworkers. It has to happen one day.
One day.
And then at that point, I will have achieved my pinnacle, and I assume, like Frodo, like I'm just going to go off on that boat and sail off to the land of death.
It's time to be immortal now.
Yeah.
Be sure to send us criticism, ask us questions, and suggest future manga for us to read in the comments section or email them to us. weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is the best place to do that. Special thanks also go out to all of our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently recorded the first movie commentary episode of the show. Did the Digimon movie and had a good old time talking about how shit it was.
And also
great memories of Digimon as well.
Yeah. So if you've watched Digimon, if you were a Digimon fan as a kid, you absolutely need to check it out. It's going to be, if you're listening to this podcast after it's gone up, if you listen to it live, it'll be up in a little bit, but if you're listening to it after it's gone up, it should already be up if you go to our Patreon, patreon.com/weeklymangarecap. You don't have to be a patron to get it, it's just going to be hosted on there, everyone can grab it, it'll be completely free. So that's where you can grab it if you're interested in it.
Woohoo!
And also, I want to give thanks to our new patrons, PK, Highly Disinterested, ES Arty, or S Arty, I'm not sure if it's pronounced ES or S, but thanks to them, and also to Evan Bishop. So thank all of you guys, we greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We're starting to get dangerously close, I feel like, to an air gear review.
Special thanks as well go to Steve Mann, our talk editor, as well as The Infamous Planet and Felix Stark, who create the visual editions of our podcast. Thank you guys so much. And time for the next suggestion for a series. This is something that has been suggested many, many, many times over the years because it's a famous, well-known, and well-regarded manga. So hopefully we're going to have a good time with this one. It's a series called Great Teacher Onizuka.
GTO.
Yeah, I'm curious to how this is going to turn out. It's about a guy who becomes a teacher, but he is not the exact kind of person you would expect to become one. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it, checking it out. I have heard it's good, so we'll see.
All right, we shall see how that goes. But I don't know. I think that works. I'm actually a little flabbergasted, Nick. I didn't think you would pull off that good of a Bill Clinton, like, on the spot.
I don't know. I don't actually believe it was good. That was literally the first time I've done a Bill Clinton impression ever. So
I feel like it was solid.
I think it's just because I just called upon my Southern roots and tried to do a Bill Clinton impression from the Bill Clinton impressions that I've heard before.
Do you want me to throw out another one from this list that I have, see if you can go 2 for 2?
Sure. Okay. No, I'm not going to go 2 for 2, probably.
All right, well, this might be a harder one for you. You got to do a Donald Trump.
Okay. I go on the internet, I hear the podcast hosts, they talk about their geeky things, and they are destroying our people's minds, they're turning kids into criminals, and some, I assume, talk about intellectual matters, but not very many. Vote Trump.
It started off a little Jewy, but it nailed it by the end.